So I've got a question for all the video game lovers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware, with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These really are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance, so I'd visit alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark.
Retronauts is part of the Greenlit Podcast Network. For more information, please go to greenlitpodcasts.com.
This week on Retronauts, we've got the pox of LeChuck, and the only cure is more Monkey Island. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mackey, and right now we are doing another episode in our LucasArts retrospective miniseries, and we're heading towards the end of this. There's still a few more games left, but this is technically a LucasArts game, and it's definitely a Monkey Island game. And yes, we're returning once again to Monkey Island, and who is here with me today to talk about this beloved series?
That sounds like something my husband might say. It's me, Nina Matsumoto.
Were you quoting Monkey Island there?
Yes, I was.
Okay, I don't remember that quote at all.
I can say it now. Oh, it's at the very end of Secret of Monkey Island. It's one of the things you can say. No, it's not one of the things Elaine says at the very end of Secret of Monkey Island.
Mm.
You know, remember when they're like watching the fireworks and you get to say something as Guybrush, like, don't pay more than $20 for an adventure game or a computer game. And then whatever you say, she says, that sounds like something my husband would say.
That game was about 300 podcasts ago for me, so I pushed that out of my brain.
Keep this in this game. That's
really?
That's why I brought it up.
Okay, interesting.
Yep,
I guess we'll get to it, but thank you for making me look incredibly bad and foolish up front with my lack of knowledge. But yes, we're going to talk about this beloved series, the final entry in Monkey Island, which is Tales of Monkey Island. And the last one we did in this series, well, we've done other LucasArts games in the series. I think the last one that we covered was The Dig. And the last Monkey Island game we covered, since we're going in order, was Escape from Monkey Island, and it was so bad that we needed 9 months of time off for Monkey Island before we got to this game, which is it's so much better.
Wasn't there like 9 years after Escape?
Yes, yeah, almost a decade.
So 9 months, 9 years, yeah. It tracks.
But if you did...
Your Dig podcast, by the way, which is great.
Oh, thank you.
I loved your guest on it. It was almost... dangerously close to turning to another Escape podcast.
It's true. It was much shorter. And I re-listened to the Escape from Monkey Island podcast just to make me remember why I disliked it so much. And even listening to that podcast put me in a bad mood because it put me back into the summer of 2020 when things seemed hopeless and I was playing that game for some reason. All right, for my podcast. And yes, this will be a much more positive podcast because we both really like this game. And I want to know, Nina, because I don't think I've ever asked you about this, what your history is with Tales of Monkey Island and also just the Telltale, kind of games in general.
I've played a few Telltale games. I played this one, Back to the Future, a bit of The Walking Dead, which I couldn't get into. I just didn't like that format. I also didn't care about Walking Dead at all. And Batman, the first one.
Okay.
And I enjoyed all those except for Walking Dead, which I couldn't get into, even though that's what... you know, kind of made Telltale games super popular. I remember I was a bit scared of this game because of how disappointing Escape was. And remember, I was also disappointed by Curse, although that's not nearly as bad as Escape, of course.
No.
It's not a bad game. I'm not saying it's bad. It's just I was disappointed by two games and it just kept getting worse for me. So I was so afraid of being burned again. Though, when I saw the designs for Guybrush and Elaine, that made me like, cautiously optimistic. Like, it looked like they were getting the game back on track. But in 2009, which is when this game came out, I was extremely busy working on the graphic novel, The Last Airbender prequel, Zuko's Story, which is a tie-in to the film. So I actually didn't play this game until I had finished inking my book in February 2010. And I found my old tweets of when I was playing this game. And judging from it, I played through all of it in 3 days. Like, I didn't have to wait in between chapters, which is nice. And I only made 4 tweets about it, which I'll read to you.
Okay.
This is before, you know, they increase the character limit. February 9th, 2010. Been playing Tales of Monkey Island since I finished inking. I love it. I need to do more Monkey Island fan art. Haven't done one in years. Also February 9th. Tales of Monkey Island thoughts. Wow, a post MI1 and MI2 game finally got Stan right. February 10th. I think I like Tales of Monkey Island more than Curse of Monkey Island. And then February 11th. Just finished Tales of Monkey Island. That was definitely better than Curse of Monkey Island, which was unexpected.
And I think, from what I remember, when I first got to know you, didn't you have a Tales of Monkey Island statue?
That wasn't Tales of Monkey Island.
Oh, I thought
that
it was.
That was based on the special edition of the first game. The one of, like, Guybrush in his, I guess, not reboot design, high-definition design, fighting high-definition LeChuck with the bottle of the root beer.
Okay, I didn't remember it being that hideous, like the redesign for Guybrush in the remastered version. That's why I thought it was the Tales of Monkey Island statue.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool that they released something like that, but I also really don't like those designs, and I think I got rid of it a while ago when I moved. I was like, this doesn't bring me joy. This is when I was like going through my Mario Kondo phase, and I was like, this doesn't spark joy. Also, like, my ex gave it to me, so it also had those memories attached to it.
I see. Yeah, well, this is related because this series and other things surrounding it are all part of a Monkey Island Renaissance that happened over 10 years ago. And I'm looking at my old tweets now, and I started Twitter in like 2008. So I was looking, did I ever talk about Tales of Monkey Island? And yes, I had a blog post on 1UP that I don't remember writing. And of course, it's no longer online. And it's called 3 Reasons Tales of Monkey Island Got It Right. And it was written after the first episode came out. So I was playing these and writing about these professionally. And yeah, my experience with the series is I played the first one and I did like it, but I did have reservations. And I think I bought the rest of them, but I didn't end up playing them until I was horribly unemployed. So I was basically unemployed from the time this game came out until about a year later. So in the middle of that, I finally played through the rest of the games, and I did love them a lot. And I was a big Telltale fan before that, too, because I didn't play their first game release, the adventure game release, which was Bone, because I was a big Bone fan. I was afraid they would get it wrong, and I still haven't played it. I don't know how good it is. I know they abandoned that series, so it's not really finished, but yeah, I didn't play Bone.
I also love Bone. Still haven't played it.
But I love the first MMX series. I love the second. And then I finally got around to playing this. And yeah, we'll talk about it throughout this episode. But it is a really, really good adventure game. And it's a very good Monkey Island game. And I don't know, because I haven't played it since we podcasted about it, but I might like it more than Curse. But I still think Curse is a very good game. But I feel like this is trying to do some different things in a respectful way.
I'm surprised to hear that, because I know you like Curse so much. Mm-hmm. And that was the first Monkey Island game you play, so you obviously hold that dear to you.
Yeah, I think Curse might win in the end just because of nostalgia, but this one is still very good. But yeah, I don't know. I was still afraid. Like you, I was like, oh no, will they get it right? And then, like you, I played through most of them in just like one long sitting, basically over a few days, and I really, really got into it.
Yeah, I haven't played it since it came out because, you know, I'm at this age where I don't replay games as much as I used to. But I thought, you know, I've always liked it and defended it. I was almost afraid to play it again because I thought, oh, what if my expectations were so low back then post-escape? And I was just fooling myself. But no, I can confidently say I love this game. And I know we can't discuss this yet, but the ending really sticks with me. And it stuck with me for 11 years ago when I first played it. And the impact is even greater now. Maybe it's because you and I haven't seen each other. You and I have seen each other just once during our pox over here.
Oh, great! And it's another fun take on a pandemic in this game. Another hilarious pandemic.
I haven't seen you since January, and I'm missing you. So, like, I'm feeling like Krusty the Clown after seeing the Itchy and Scratchy cartoon about father and son when he's missing his father a lot. This game is so sweet, and it's a wonderful tribute to Guybrush and Elaine's relationship. And this is the only game where I feel their relationship feels genuine and believable.
Yes, and it's not the we talked about it in Escape. It's not like the kind of henpecked husband kind of thing they were going for in that game. It does feel like they you could see why they fell in love. She's not just tolerating him.
And they really could have gone down that route again, mm-hmm. especially with the introduction of kind of sort of a love rival.
Yes.
Not exactly, but sort of a love rival. But they didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's
what makes
it great.
I love how they handle the marriage and the new character. We'll get into more of the details later. I do want to let our listeners know that the front half of this episode will be like production information and just a broad overview of what this is. And the back half will be more spoiler focused about different puzzles. And up front, also, this game is still you can still buy it on Steam. It's $14.99. It's like amounts to maybe a 15 to 20 hour experience across five chapters. It's definitely worth it. Another company has purchased Telltale and is now distributing their game, so this is still online and it's still playable with a modern computer. Nina, you have a new computer and you had no problems playing it at all, I take it.
Yeah, and when Telltale shut down and they started removing their games from online stores, I got scared and I immediately went on eBay and bought the DVD collection of it because I didn't back then. And that's what I played it off of. Well, I installed it off of that.
Ooh, fancy. I do have that DVD, but I was planning on checking it out for this podcast, but then I noticed that all the extras are on YouTube because that's where all DVD extras live now. So there's very little reason.
I didn't get a chance to check those out.
Oh, it's a lot of really good commentaries because Telltale, so this is our Telltale section. We'll talk about them. If you want to know a lot more about Telltale, go back to episode 366. I talked to two former Telltale developers, now with Skunk Ape Games, or Skunk Ape Games, however you want to say it is fine. They recently put out the remastered version of Sam & Max Save the World. And we talk about, you know, the Telltale tool, what the production of episodic games was like. So you can have some more insight onto the inside of Telltale at the time through that episode. And I also recommend, Telltale shut down a few years ago. I believe it was 2018. There's been a lot written about that, but there's a really great Game Informer article called The Rise and Fall of Telltale Games. And you can see where that studio went and why it's gone today, and it's very unfortunate. And Monkey Island, Tales of Monkey Island, comes at the end of the company's first arc, and the second arc really kicks off with The Walking Dead and everything to follow in that same more story-focused format. But we're still in the era of Telltale where they are trying to make an adventure game revival in 2009.
And they did a good job. I'm kind of disappointed that they went with the Walking Dead formula after that became a big hit.
I don't know how you feel, Nina, because I played all the Sam & Max episode season one games recently for that podcast, and I walked away thinking, oh, this is the perfect format for an adventure game because you can finish it in one or two sittings, and it is a manageable size, and the puzzles can be tricky, but it's never something that's unfair. I feel like they really figured it out, and that's why I'm disappointed that they left this format behind, and now they're just gone forever.
Yeah, I like this format too. I mean, we could talk about the design of the game more later, but because of the episodic nature, I like that you start off each chapter with like fresh inventory.
Yeah.
Things get cleared out in a natural way. And also, because of the episodic nature, the story gets stronger too, because they got to find a good cliffhanger at the end of each act. And that's something we didn't really have in the previous Monkey Island games.
That's right. Yeah, the previous Monkey Island games, they technically had chapters in them, but they didn't feel as distinct as the chapters in this game.
Mm-hmm, 'cause they knew you were going to keep playing.
Yeah. So I want to talk a bit more about Telltale, just a mini history of them in case you miss them or in case you don't remember. So they were started in 2004 by some former LucasArts employees in the studio. Their main goal was to prove there was a viable marketplace for adventure games. And the studio rose after the cancellation of high-profile adventure games at LucasArts like Full Throttle 2 and Sam & Max Freelance Police. Those were the two big adventure games that were canceled and really the company was like, we are just making Star Wars games now and non-adventure things. And Telltale rose as a response to that. And yeah, this was an era in which, you know, Steam, I believe, was a 2004 release, only publishing Valve games at that point. But still, digital distribution was the future in 2004, and Telltale saw it that way. And the way that their marketplace worked at first, at least, is that you bought games episodically through their website, one episode at a time, and then when the final episode released, usually you could order a DVD with all of them on there and extras and things like that. I think over time, Telltale would have you buy all the episodes up front. I forget if Monkey Island, Tales of Monkey Island worked like that, but at least initially it was you buy one episode at a time. They were like $7 or $8, and then at the end there'd be a collection.
No, I remember my friend gifted me the season pass for Tales of Monkey Island.
Yeah, I think maybe with The Walking Dead it started like, no, you just buy the whole season up front and then we just drip feed it to you. But yeah, I think at this point they were still episodic. And Telltale's first game was actually a Texas Hold'em game, because they were like, we don't want to spend a lot of money on a, you know, production. We want to see if how viable digital distribution is. And apparently this was enough to, you know, keep them afloat so they could make things like CSI games and Bone, and eventually they would get the rights to Sam and Max, because LucasArts didn't own those rights. Steve Purcell did. So they went for those first, and the Sam and Max season one came out in 2006 and really kicked off the revival of LucasArts IP for them.
It seems like from the very beginning, although I haven't played a lot of those early games, Telltale Games was held up a lot by their writing and their voice acting.
Held up in terms of...
like, that was, like, a big draw to their game.
Yes, yes. Very good writing, very good voice acting, and all done in the Bay Area, too, for the most part. But, yeah, soon things would be changing for Telltale, because this would be one of their final traditional adventure games, because we have this. I'll tell you where this takes place in the timeline. So this comes before Sam and Max Season 3 and before the Back to the Future game, which those three releases were their last adventure game releases in the traditional model. In 2012 came The Walking Dead Season 1, and because of the success of that, they made every game basically take that format. It was a... I think there was just like one puzzle in the first Walking Dead season, but that was it. And after that, it was like, it's, you know, dialogue and it's quick time events and it's making tough moral decisions. And that's what every game was, that format. And because of that, they were kind of hamstrung in that they really bit off more than they could chew a lot, because they would buy a lot of expensive IP. Like, I forgot they did a Game of Thrones adventure game. That's something that they did. And they...
Oh, yeah.
And they never really were able to rework their engine. It was a very old and crusty engine by the end. They were never able to rework it because they just couldn't stop making things because they acquired so much IP. And they weren't able to change the format of their games either, because when they approach a studio or an IP holder, their pitch was always, we'll do for your series what we did for The Walking Dead. And that was an easy pitch for them. They were not about to reinvent themselves after they found out what made them most successful. And that's personally where I stopped caring about the company, because I love Walking Dead Season 1. I believe I reviewed it for 1UP and gave it an A+. I thought it was really well done and worked on me. And I kind of stalled out halfway through Walking Dead Season 2. And then every other Telltale game I tried, I just walked away saying, you know, I've done this. I've played this kind of experience before, and I can see the strings. I can see the behind the scenes, what's happening here, and it doesn't really work on me anymore. And that's where I just fell off with their games entirely. Just basically maybe like 2013, and there would still be things like Game of Thrones and Borderlands and what else? There's also
Jurassic Park.
That is awful. I think that gave that game an F for 1UP. Jurassic Park was weird game, because it was delayed forever and it was barely an adventure game. I think it was a series of quick time events.
Yeah.
Awful.
Yeah, I liked the Back to the Future one enough that I wanted to try the Jurassic Park one, but then the reviews were bad. And then later I tried to watch a playthrough on YouTube and it was just too boring to watch.
Yeah, I think I personally angered Telltale with my review, because when they came to 1UP with the demo of Walking Dead, it felt like they had something to prove, and they did like impress me. So that they really recovered from that. But yeah,
It also feels like near the beginning they're mostly doing humorous games, which works for this format, because when you're playing an adventure game, it's always going to be a little bit weird and goofy. It kind of has to be, because your character actions are so like unnatural. You're going around stealing things. You say, you feel like saying things just to like see what the person's reaction is. So when you shift to a more serious format, like they did with Walking Dead and a lot of other games onwards, then all of a sudden that format, it just becomes kind of silly.
Yeah,
for,
yeah.
Like, a serious narrative.
I don't remember.
I remember when I was playing the first Batman game they released. At some point, like, so when you're doing the dialogue in those, they gave you a certain amount of time to think of a response. And after a while, I just started, like, there's always a one response that's just like dot, 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 which is say nothing. At a certain point, I started just selecting that for everything. Like, you play Bruce Wayne in that game, more so Bruce Wayne than Batman. And in every conversation, I would just, like, not respond. But the character he's talking to would keep talking anyway. And it was just so funny.
Yeah, I mean, they can only do so much with your input in those games. And again, like, once you play enough of them, you realize, like, oh, maybe a few major choices really matter. But a lot of minor ones, they are just, they have no effect on what happens next. And again, like, for me, after I played Walking Dead Season 1, I was like, okay, I get it. This is really fun, but I kind of want something else now. But that's what put them on the map, and that's what made them go into overdrive, and that's eventually following that model is what killed them. But thankfully, a lot of their games are still available. Other companies have bought the rights and are re-releasing, like, very well-done remastered versions, and apparently, whoever owns the rights to Telltale stuff now, whoever acquired the IP, they announced the sequel to The Wolf Among Us at the Game Awards in 2019, but I've never seen anything come of that yet.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. They're also going to do a Stranger Things game, and that got canceled.
Right, yeah. And they also acquired the rights to King's Quest, but then
yes,
that one studio got it, and I guess they used money for a Homestuck game to make the King's Quest game. Some kind of scandal happened
there. Yeah,
there's
like a lot of drama surrounding that. I don't completely understand it myself. I was excited when Telltale got the rights to King's Quest. I thought, well, they did Monkey Island really well. They could probably do King's Quest pretty well too. And it was disappointing when they lost the rights to that. And then the Odd Gentleman one, I didn't like it.
I thought it was fine.
I got the season pass to it, but I never finished playing it. There's like two or three more chapters I got to play, and I just don't feel like playing it.
I reviewed the first one for US Gamer, and I liked it. And then they sent me a survey saying, do you want to review the second game? And I filled it out, but they never actually sent it to me. So it's their loss.
The first one was okay, but I don't know. The more I kept playing it, I'm like, I don't like these action parts at all. This is not what King's Quest is. I really wish Telltale could have done it.
They should have made a punishing game with a horrible owl creature.
Cedric is in the game.
He is? I guess I didn't know who Cedric was when I played it. Now I'm way too familiar with Cedric from King's Quest
V. He's like in the third or fourth chapter.
Okay. I only made it to chapter one. But yeah, that is the Telltale story. Now let's talk about Tales of Monkey Island, the production of this game. So before we begin, this over 10 years ago, it wasn't that long ago, but it's a much different time because this is right before Disney acquired all of the LucasArts and Lucas properties. So in 2009, LucasArts is still an independent company. In October of 2012, that's when Disney buys all of Lucas IP. So we were right before that. And in 2008, LucasArts had a new president named Daryl Rodriguez, who had an interest in reviving some of their old IP. It had been 8 years since Escape from Monkey Island. And basically, according to Dave Grossman, who worked on this game and worked on things like the original Monkey Island games and Day of the Tentacle, he said this came about because the right people on both sides were interested. Like, Telltale always had this in the back of their head. Dave Grossman always wanted to do another Monkey Island game. But this president just had an interest in reviving some of their old IP, which is why we had a real Monkey Island revival between 2009 and 2010. So in those two short years, we had a new 5-episode Monkey Island game and also a remake of Monkey Island 1 and 2. We didn't know how good we had it, but that was like a great time for Monkey Island lovers.
We were really spoiled.
Yes.
Who knows when we'll see something like that again, now that Disney has it.
And we had a few things since then, like the Day of the Tentacle Remastered Edition and the Full Throttle Remastered Edition and Grim Fandango, but there have not been new games for those series. There were just remakes, and they were well done, but still, this felt like a real celebration of Monkey Island. People were talking about it. As someone who was a bit new to writing about games professionally, I was having a good chance to blog about it and do write about Monkey Island for money.
I wonder if Telltale thought like this would be the beginning of them doing a bunch of other LucasArts games, like Full Throttle, and they could probably do a good Grim Fandango as well.
Yeah, I think ultimately what their downfall was, so I thought it was The Walking Dead. Walking Dead was a big success, a huge success. But in reading about their history, it was Back to the Future that really made them turn towards more known IP, more like mainstream IP. So Back to the Future, before The Walking Dead, that was their highest selling series. And that's, I think, getting Back to the Future is what made them seek out The Walking Dead. Because they're like, oh, people love this. They love Jurassic Park. Let's go for the big name. So I feel like Tales of Monkey Island, like, everything was profitable for them seemingly, but the amount of people who know about Tales of Monkey Island is much smaller than people who know about Walking Dead or Back to the Future or Game of Thrones or Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I played the Back to the Future game, but I guess that was more narrative driven. There weren't too many actual puzzles.
It was light on puzzles. It was not quite like a Walking Dead or you know, that kind of experience, but there were still some adventure game elements in there. That really feels like their last adventure game in this format, for sure. We can talk about people behind the project. Dave Grossman, someone who I've interviewed in the past, he was with Tim Schafer and Ron Gilbert, the three guys who basically wrote and put together Monkey Island 1 and 2. He is the kind of coordinator of this series, and he, when he found out he had the rights to this or they could make this game, the first person he called was Ron Gilbert. Ron Gilbert, of course, he's been on Retronauts. I've interviewed him plenty of times. I'm sure you've talked to him too, Nina, in your history. You did the Thimbleweed Park Arts cover art for that game. And yeah, so Dave Grossman said the first person I wanted to call was Ron Gilbert, and getting him to work on this series was difficult because at the time he was creative director of Hothead Games. He was making the Diablo-like called Deathspank, but he was able to come down for a week to basically have a bunch of meetings and, you know, brainstorming sessions. And I think that really helps make this game feel more official than the other Monkey Island sequels.
Oh, yeah. Hothead Games, based in Vancouver, where I live.
That's true.
I know someone who worked on Deathspank, actually. He had never played any of Ron Gilbert's games. Mm. And they asked him about it in his interview. He was just like, I don't know these games. I never played them. Well, he said that, like, it seems like a lot of people there were, like, super fanboys of Ron Gilbert. But, you know, his personality, Ron Gilbert's personality, he's not, he doesn't like being, like, doted on, I guess.
That's true. That's true.
So I think that worked in his favor.
Yeah. When I talked to Ron Gilbert, he really downplays how much of an effect he had on this series. When I asked him about it over, I think during like Thimbleweed Park interviews, I just had a few questions about this series. He's like, oh, yeah, I really didn't have much to do with that. I just had a few meetings and that was it. But it sounds like he was there for a week. And, you know, he really informed a lot of the decisions that went into this game. So I really feel like without him, this could be a much worse product. And I feel like his stamp of approval is does mean a lot to me as someone who's a fan of this game.
Oh, totally. And if you'll remember what my thoughts about Curse of Monkey Island is that it's a fine game. It's a good game. I just didn't like it as a Monkey Island game.
Mm.
I like this game a lot because it feels like a Monkey Island game.
Yes, it really does. And one notable omission from this game is Tim Schafer. So Dave said in some interviews, I got Ron to work on the project, but getting him to work for us while already employed at another company was way too difficult to do. So I did not want to get Tim involved because, of course, Tim Schafer, at that point, he had been a Double Fine, the CEO or president or whatever, for 9 years. And I think that's fine because what I'm learning over my history of playing games, and I know Tim Schafer is a very nice man, who's done a lot for the world of gaming. I don't think I like Tim Schafer games very much. I didn't like Full Throttle. I tolerate Grim Fandango. I don't like Psychonauts that much, although I do appreciate the writing and the art and the music and stuff. I don't know. Maybe there's a Tim Schafer game I haven't played that I will love, but I feel like his sense of design is not something I'm as into as, you know, Dave Grossman or some of these other developers.
Yeah, I like Full Throttle, but I understand the flaws with it. I totally agree with all your podcast when we talked about all the flaws. I don't like Grim Fandango. I know that feels like a sacrilegious thing to say as an adventure game fan. I just never got into it.
Mm.
I didn't like Psychonauts either.
I know, I mean, it takes all kinds and, you know, taste is relative, but I played Psychonauts because of the Tim Schafer connection, and I like some parts of it, but it was just a struggle to get through that game. So when people are fans of it, I'm just confused. But Psychonauts 2 could be very good. I think it's not tied down to, like, bad 3D game technology. It could be a much better game. I'm looking forward to seeing what that how that turns out.
I think he's great at finding a good visual style for all those games.
Yeah, he's good at finding the like the right people to put, you know, the artistic side together for sure.
Yeah.
So, yes, Ron Gilbert's on the game, Dave Grossman's on the game, and there's some great interviews from this period that are still online, thankfully, about the production of this game, and it seems like he regretted saying this because a lot of people took it too literally, but Grossman says, this is technically the sixth Monkey Island game because it opens with Guybrush and Elaine at the end of what would have been the fifth game, which I think is
I kind of love that.
Yeah, it's a super creative way to start a game. And I do like imagining just like, oh, what did they do to get into this situation? It's a really great way to start off the game.
I always find it hilarious in anything when characters reference things that we've never seen.
Yeah.
They do that a lot in the beginning of this game. I like anything that starts in media res as well.
Mm-hmm. It was a great, yeah, it's a great little bottle puzzle to start off this first episode. And other things Grossman said is that this was the first Monkey Island game to be made in a world in which Pirates of the Caribbean, the movie series, existed. So, of course, that had a lot of influence on the design of this game. Not like they were explicitly borrowing things from the series, but when you live in the world of 2009, and this is like one of the most popular franchises on Earth, it cannot not affect you. And I find that very funny because it's such an incestuous relationship because Monkey Island 1, very much inspired by both Pirates of the Caribbean, The Ride, and the novel On Stranger Tides. And then in 2011, this is so confusing, the fourth Pirates of the Caribbean movie is an adaptation of the novel On Stranger Tides, but they just put in characters from that series. So it all came together eventually.
So did he say this in the commentary that you listened to?
I don't think it ever came up, but it is factual.
Okay, did they like elaborate like what exactly they were inspired by? Was it like the story or like visually or what?
They just said they were, I mean, it had an influence on them, I think is what was said. There was nothing direct stated, but I just find it very funny that these, like, Monkey Island and On Stranger Tides came together as a Pirates of the Caribbean movie, and apparently there was a Monkey Island movie in the works, just like how there's a movie for everything in the works. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really mean anything, but apparently the screenwriters for that Monkey Island movie, they might have changed that script into On Stranger Tides for the Pirates of the Caribbean fourth movie, which I have not seen. I have not seen.
Well, as you know, I watched all the Pirates of the Caribbean movie during the pandemic. That was an interesting project. And it kind of surprises me to hear this was influenced by the series. Because I don't see too much of a connection, but aside from the whole pirate thing and undead thing, which was there from the very beginning for both franchises.
Yeah.
I could kind of see how they could be inspired by the third movie, which was the latest movie that had come out in that series by this point, because it's centered around love, death, and sacrifice, and explores like Orlando Bloom's character and Keira Knightley's character's relationship some more. That's a movie where they get married and they get wedded during a huge sword fight in a ship, which feels like something, you know, Guybrush and Elaine might do. Unfortunately, they didn't get to do that because of the rushed ending of Curse of Monkey Island.
Yeah.
But yeah, like on Stranger Tides, the fourth movie, which came out after this, there's this guy called, there's a character called Philip Swift who falls in love with a mermaid, and his whole look and vibe really reminded me of Guybrush. Like the Guybrush from our first two games.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if I'll get around to the fourth Pirates movie watching it. Maybe I'll watch the first one eventually. I'm disappointed in myself, though, because I wanted to read On Stranger Tides before doing one of these podcasts. I just never got around to it, but I did add it to my Amazon wish list, the Tim Powers novel. So I think maybe the next time I fly out to Canada, I will read it on my flight because I've always wanted to. I want to see why this novel inspired Ron Gilbert so much, and I'm sure it's a very good and funny novel.
We should go through all the Pirates of the Caribbean movies together when you're here. We have lots of time.
It's true. If I have to quarantine, maybe, but we have to drink a lot of rum.
You can Yeah, lots of ramen. You could look at your phone during the third one, okay, because that one goes on forever.
Just give me the gist of it. I'll be playing Candy Crush or something in the background. So yeah, we could talk about other designers who worked on this. So I must correct myself. I made myself look foolish because this guy, we talked about him before in other podcasts, and I keep saying Mike Stemmel. His name, based on how it's spelled, should not be pronounced this way, but he chooses to. His name is actually Mike Stemmley. So every time I've said Stemmel, I've said it incorrectly. So if you want to be an Industrious Retronauts fan, go back and I'll say Stemmley. You can just plop that into every time I missaid Stemmel, and then it'll be perfectly fine and correct. But the entire time, only until I heard the commentary did I hear him say, "I'm Mike Stemmley." I tried to find, you know, audio interviews where he said his name, but only when I've heard the commentary, he actually says his name. So that secret has been solved.
Okay. Yeah, it's kind of like how you keep mispronouncing John Lithgow as John Lithgow.
Yes.
Based on how it's spelled.
And that
bothers you.
I think I've got it now. In that Trek podcast, okay, I did for our other podcast series, I think I got it maybe 60% of the time.
You mispronounced his name at least once.
Mm.
And I'll never forgive you for it.
Well, I'll apologize to the man if I ever meet him. So I got to say, we were not very nice to Mike Stemmley in our Escape from Monkey Island podcast, because Mike Stemmley, until Tales of Monkey Island, I was not a fan of his games, because Mike Stemmley and Sean Clark were the two guys who made Escape from Monkey Island. Mike Stemmley also worked on another adventure game that I like more than Escape from Monkey Island, but I think it's very flawed. You can hear the podcast about that. Mike Stemmley and Sean Clark, Sam and Max Hit the Road was really their first game as directors. So, and then Mike Stemmley was the director of Afterlife as well, that Afterlife sim we talked about in previous episodes. So I think he found the right people to work with, because this series, I don't see any of the problems I had with his previous games at all. I think with Dave Grossman there and other developers, I think he found the right people to maybe calm down his bad design qualities, or at least talk him out of certain puzzle ideas.
So listening to your podcast series about these adventure games made me like way more aware of the people who worked on these games.
Mm, that's good.
And and after listening to your podcast about those other games he worked on, I was really surprised to find out that he did this one. It doesn't feel like one of his games.
Yeah, he's a major name on this, and he worked on a lot of Telltale stuff I do like. And I think he found the right people to work with, and the games he's worked on, I love them all. And he directed the first episode, had a major presence on the rest of the series. So yeah, that's Mike Stemmley. Again, a LucasArts talent from way back in the day. Some new talent on the series, though. We're just going to go over the directors right now, because there's a lot of designers, but I'm just going to talk about the directors up front here. So there's Mark Darin. So he's an adventure game designer who came from the very, very indie Nick Bounty series of adventure games. And I didn't know what this was, so I looked up videos, and they looked to me to be like Newgrounds-style adventure games from the early 2000s. I don't know if you could purchase these. I think they were just playable in Flash in your like browser. But based on his work on those, he was hired by Telltale, and he'd be with them for a decade and worked on a lot of their series. And I went on to Steam. That was the first place I went to look for Nick Bounty. There is a new Nick Bounty game that came out in 2020. So if you are a fan of the series, he did work on a new one, Mark Darin.
I looked up screenshots from it, and it looks pretty cool. It's black and white. It's very noir. Seems like something you would like.
It did look neat. Yeah, I want to check out the old games. I'm sure they're playable somewhere. And if you go onto YouTube to look up playthroughs, they're maybe like 20 minutes long because just one guy made them. So yeah, that's where he came from, indie adventure game areas. And also Joe Pinney. So he's another director on this series. He didn't have a lot of credits outside of Telltale. One I saw was he was producer on an adaptation of the movie Congo for the PlayStation. And I'm not sure if that's just some guy with the same name or actually him, because it's weird that he would have no credits and then work on Congo and then 10 years later work at Telltale. But who knows? People's lives are weird. But he worked on their series from the Wallace and Gromit series to the Game of Thrones series. So he was on a lot of Telltale stuff as well.
I feel like every time you bring up Game of Thrones, I'm surprised that they did that, because I've completely forgotten about it.
We collectively as a society, 2019 was just the end of so many things, including normal life. There was a bad Game of Thrones finale and a bad Star Wars finale, and let's just forget about both of those things. Star Wars is now a bunch of TV shows, and Game of Thrones, what's that? I never heard of it. So yeah, that's Joe Pinney and Jake Rodkin. So number one, most important thing about Jake Rodkin, he was a Retronauts guest. So he is on that Sam and Max Save the World episode. So he was part of the enthusiast developer pipeline, as a lot of people are, including me. So he started out writing for websites like Adventure Gamers, International House of Mojo, and he was part of the Idle Thumbs podcast when that was around for about a decade. A lot of people love that podcast. In fact, because of their Kickstarter, that's where I got the idea, like, oh, we can have a Kickstarter for Retronauts. So you can blame or thank them for the fact that we've been around for so long. And Jake Rodkin would go on to found Campo Santo, who made Firewatch. And in 2018, they were acquired by Valve, and they've done work on things like Half-Life Alyx. So that is where Jake came from and where he is now. And he was also on the, I believe, Full Throttle episode of Retronauts.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I gotta wonder if he was a major player when it came to getting this game right, like being someone who was a big fan.
So
he knew what worked and what didn't.
I think his presence helped. He was on Telltale Games, I think, from Sam & Max Season 1 onwards. And a lot of the time, he was doing UI stuff and web design for Telltale. They had a very nice-looking website back in the day. But he eventually moved into design, and I believe this is his first game as a director at Telltale, or just a game as a game director at all. But yeah, I think having a fan and someone who knew the series very, very well did really inform the series, and he knows a lot about Monkey Island.
And Escape from Monkey Island was also made by fans and kind of for fans, but there was too much fan service in a way,
yes.
Not in a good way. Whereas this one has some fan service, but it doesn't go too far with it, and it still comes up with its own stuff.
I agree with that, and we'll talk more about it and when we talk about the game itself, but I feel like what the series does best, or sorry, what this entry does best, Tales of Monkey Island, is I feel like Curse and Escape, although I love Curse, they were like, okay, what does a Monkey Island game do? Let's do all those things. This game was like, what does a Monkey Island game do? Let's find an inversion or a subversion of all of those things. And I think they really do a good job of, like, they really surprise you throughout this series. And of course, we have the return of Michael Land to do the music. Like Curse of Monkey Island, this is just him doing it. And I think now we can discuss about what we thought about the soundtrack. When I was playing it, nothing really stood out to me, but I did enjoy it. But then when I was going back through videos of the soundtrack to pull music for Retronauts to put in this episode, I was like, oh, this is actually really, really good. And I don't know why I didn't notice as much while playing the game, but I think this is a really good soundtrack.
Okay, I've never listened to the soundtrack on its own, unlike what I've done with the first three games. And kind of like Escape, it rehashes a lot of the same music, and it doesn't stand out to me. Maybe I just need to listen to it on its own to really appreciate it.
Yeah, and
LeChuck's Revenge is where the music peaked in the series, and it really hasn't been the same since.
I don't think they can beat that, LeChuck's Revenge. But in this game, I feel like the first episode does have the return of a lot of themes, but I also think they come up with a lot of new themes, or Michael Land does, at least. And I do like, there's the LeChuck theme, but they find a new way to interpret it because he's a human and seemingly a good guy. So you get a different version of the LeChuck theme. And they have,
yes.
I like the theme for the new villain. I have it stuck in my head. I like the different variations on that. Like, if you go back and just listen to the soundtrack independently, I think you might have a better appreciation of it, just because it is kind of buried underneath, you know, all the dialogue. But it does, I think he did a really great job with all this music he had to write.
It's funny that you bring those two up, because those two tracks are the ones that stand out in my head. LeChuck's theme in a major key instead of a minor key is mm-hmm. really cool. And the Marquis de Sanges theme, that definitely is one I can recall in my head. If you ask me to think of a Tales of Monkey Island song, like, I could think of that. I can't think of anything else, though.
Mm.
I can't remember anything else.
I love the music in the area with inside the manatee belly with all of the Brotherhood members. It'll be in this episode.
I just don't remember it.
It'll be in
this
episode.
If I just sing a song from the game, I just can't.
But
just the Marquis de Sanges and the LeChuck theme.
The Marquis de Sanges thing theme was one of the best songs in the game, and I think it's hard to top like the character themes from the series. But I think he made something on par with, you know, the Guybrush and Elaine theme and the LeChuck theme and the main theme. I think it's as strong as those ones.
Ever since they introduced voice acting to the series, the music kind of had to take a backseat.
That's true.
This is the only game in the series that I recall that takes away music for emotional impact in certain scenes. Like, there's a huge thing that happens at one point in the story, and that it's eerily silent, so you get the time to soak in what just happened. And like, silence is used especially well at the very end of the game, during the very last thing you do, and that's also for emotional impact.
Yeah, this game, in terms of just the emotional quality of it, I feel like it takes some risks in terms of there's actually a few moments of sincerity in the game when even the best Monkey Island games like 1 and 2, they're incredibly sarcastic. They're spooky. They have some like melancholy to them, but I feel like they never dared to try to be this sincere. So let's talk about the voice actors. And of course, Dominic Armato is back playing Guybrush. This is a great time for him, of course, because we're doing this Monkey Island Renaissance, so he's not only revoicing Guybrush in Monkey Island 1 and 2, which did not have voice acting originally, he is coming back to do Guybrush throughout 5 chapters of this. He does sound a bit older, but I think he does a great job, and I think he's directed well, and I'm always happy to hear him playing Guybrush. It was a great choice. He was a great find back in 1996, wherever they found him.
You're so good at picking out little nuances in voices. Like, I didn't notice him sounding older at all.
Well, we all sound older. And the last time he voiced Guybrush was 10 years ago. And I've been on Retronauts for 10 years. So if you go back to a 10-year-old podcast to hear me on it, I'd sound a lot younger.
Well, it kind of makes sense for the series. He is a little bit more mature in this one.
Yeah, it's supposed to take place a few years after Escape, but I can't really place how old Guybrush is supposed to be in this game. He's got like kind of like lines under his eyes. He looks a little older, like in his late 20s, early 30s, maybe. He does seem like he's aged a bit since we saw him last.
He's got his beard back.
Yeah, he grew his beard back. We could talk more about the design
right,
later.
Like Dominic Armato is great, as always. Like, absolutely zero complaints there. If you want to interview him, like, I know someone who's friends with him, so maybe.
I think he's always game to talk about Monkey Island. Like, whenever I look up Monkey Island interviews, he's kind of done the most. And I think he's in Arizona. He's on Twitter. I just followed him on Twitter, and I think he just got out of the food reviewing game. But most of his posts are about food. And other voice actors that returned are Alexandra Boyd playing Elaine. So the American Elaine from Escape from Monkey Island is gone, and we're back to British Elaine, who I prefer. I do like British Elaine a lot more. Mm-hmm. I don't like the choice they made for Escape. I don't know if she wasn't available or they didn't like what the previous designers and casters did for the previous game. But yes, in Curse it was Boyd, in Escape it was somebody else, and now we're back to Alexandra Boyd. And Elaine, she's not in the game a lot, but I do like how she's portrayed in this. She's in it a lot more than she was in Curse.
I feel like they just didn't want to bring back anything from Escape in here.
It's for the best.
They don't want to acknowledge that game. Yeah. Elaine didn't get to say a whole lot in Curse back when she Alexandra Boyd voiced her last time. She has the most lines in the intro in Curse, and you get a bit of her midway through, but then at the end, she's gagged and unable to speak.
Mm.
And the ending is so abrupt, no one gets to say anything at the end of that one.
Yeah, everyone's just waving, like, goodbye.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm glad that Alexandra Boyd got to act way more in this and go through a huge range of emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She even becomes an evil pirate demon, too, towards the end of the game. Spoilers. And one of the other major players is back, only for the final episode, though. So Earl Bowen comes back to play LeChuck. Earl Bowen, he retired, actually, in the mid-aughts. And if you see a picture of him, you've seen him in a ton of things. He's been in a ton of movies, a ton of TV shows. He is a recognizable character actor. But when I started playing the series, or replaying it, rather, recently for this podcast, when LeChuck is at the beginning of Chapter 1 as, you know, the demon form, I was like, oh, they couldn't get Earl Bowen back. That's a bummer. I had memories of him being in this. But when I got to Chapter 4 at the end of that one, when he does come back, I was like, oh, it's him. They got him somehow. They finally got around to getting him. So apparently he was retired, but he was convinced to come back to play LeChuck in one chapter. And I assume that if they ever make more of these games, he probably won't be back.
I was surprised to find out Earl Bowen didn't reprise his role at first because it sounds a lot like him to me.
Yeah, they found a guy who could do a reasonable imitation, but I have a good ear for voice acting, so I could tell when it's Earl Bowen and when it isn't.
Yeah, so that doesn't bother me because to me it sounds like him, but also it kind of makes sense if he doesn't sound entirely like his previous self because he isn't entirely his previous self because he's human in this game.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, you know what? I do like how, I mean, it was not their choice, but I like how it's a different voice actor for the human form because Earl Bowen is an older man and he's really putting on a voice for LeChuck. And when he is in Monkey Island 2, when he's disguising his voice as Fester Shinetop, I think we talked about that in the podcast where it's like, you can definitely tell it's him because it's just Earl Bowen voicing a different character.
Right. Yeah.
So the mystery is not really there. It's just like, oh, why is Earl Bowen doing this character? I wonder why. And other people, so like, I believe Telltale just hired out of the Bay Area to do a lot of their voice acting, so it's not like LA talent like LucasArts would get for their games. So other returning characters are Stan and the Voodoo Lady, and they are voiced by Bay Area voice actors, and they were not any of the original voice actors from either Curse or Escape. So these are entirely new actors for both characters. And Nina, how did you feel about the portrayals of Stan and Voodoo Lady?
As I said in my tweet from 2010, they got Stan right. Mm-hmm. This is probably my favorite voice Stan, not just in the voice, but visually as well. They really nailed it.
And it's funny that we envisioned him as a Lionel Hutz character when he does play an attorney in this. He's a prosecutor. He's not a defense attorney, but still, they did find a good
it's
place
perfect.
For him. Yeah. Voodoo
I
Lady.
I gotta wonder if they kind of want to go for a Lionel Hutz vibe.
It seems like it. They do seem informed by that. And one thing I will say is that the Voodoo Lady is voiced by a white woman, just like how Bosco and Sam and Max is voiced by a white man. And I feel like if there is a remaster, I wonder if they'll recast her, because they did that for the remaster of Sam and Max. But they were not doing like racial appropriate casting back in the day. And now I kind of could tell when playing the game, I was like, oh, that's not because previously the voice actor for Voodoo Lady was black, but now they have a white woman putting on this voice, which, you know, it's something they wouldn't do these days.
Yeah, I like her performance, though. It works.
Yeah, yeah.
And she also has a lot of lines in this game, the Voodoo Lady.
I like her intros, too, when she intros every chapter in the series.
Yes, that's perfect. Mm-hmm.
With a purposeful grimace and a terrible smile, join Nikki and Wyatt as we stomp our way through the history of Toho's Daikaiju films in Discuss All Monsters.
Are you telling me we're going to discuss all monsters?
We won't stop until there isn't a monster left to discuss. Smash that play button like Godzilla and King Kong smash an 18th century Japanese pagoda.
Only on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
And we're back, folks, with another episode of Nasty Labs.
Nasty Labs.
It's a show hosted by me, Kinsey Burke, and my dumbass friend Mark.
Nasty Labs.
This twice-monthly show about game development, Japan life, being nice to people, and hey, maybe a few other things.
Nasty Labs
is a product of Chuhai Labs Brand Incorporated, and now available for 3 easy payments of $420.69. Only on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
So now let's talk about general stuff about the game, and then we'll get into our more spoiler-heavy discussion, and we're almost an hour into the podcast, so we really love talking about this game. So this game came out between July and December of 2009 in 5 installments, and I want to go over the basic elements of this game. So the interface, let's talk about that first. So we're at the point in history in which Telltale games are beginning to get more console-friendly, so this game is technically designed to be played with a controller, and it's much, much easier to play than Escape ever was. So just erase all memories of how hard to play that game was from your brain. But I never played it with a controller. It's perfectly playable with a mouse. And essentially what happens is when you you hold in the left mouse button, a little ring appears around Guybrush, and you just drag him in whatever direction you want him to go. And it's very, very simple. I prefer just to point and click and have him go there himself, but in terms of steering him around, it was never a pain. He never went where he wasn't supposed to go. It didn't feel like steering a boat like it did with Escape from Monkey Island. So I say thumbs up to this movement interface. How did you feel about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if we're going to compare everything in this game to Escape, this game is just superior to Escape in every single aspect. I don't want to go on too long about that comparison, But I've seen some people say, like, oh yeah, Escape from Monkey Island wasn't great, but at least it wasn't like Tails. But after playing this, I'm like, how could you like Escape more than Tails? Like, yeah. Tails is so much better in every single way. And controls are so important in an adventure game. Yeah, they did a really good job with this. I didn't like using just a mouse. I used the WASD keys, and I used shift to run while clicking with my mouse. Maybe it's because I played so much FF14 during the lockdown, but I liked using the two together.
Yeah, I forgot you could use WASD, but yeah, it's perfectly fine. And I'm glad you brought up Escape, because it just shows you how much we learned about 3D controls in 10 years. Like, we figured it out. Escape was just like, well, tank controls are the one solution for this kind of movement. Let's just do it. But here, it's easy to do. It's also a one-click interface. There's no verbs. There's kind of a cheat in which when Guybrush gets a hook in the game, the hook is often used as a verb. It's like a verb that's hidden in your inventory, kind of. That's how I think of it. But it's fine. I'm not going to knock points off for that. And throughout this adventure game discussion, we've been talking about the issue of the inventory, and that for the inventory, it's always like it's going to either be, you know, a bar at the bottom of the screen, or you're going to have an icon on the screen at all times. I like the solution for this, in which the inventory does not appear until you mouse all the way over to the right side of the screen, and then you can pull it out like a map. I really think it's a great solution. You don't always have an ugly icon on the screen at all times.
My problem with Curse was that the inventory box took up the entire screen.
That too,
that's
yeah.
That's resolved. My problem with Escape was how you had to scroll through a ring menu.
That's
was really
awful.
Tedious.
I forgot about that until I listened to that podcast. I'm like, I forgot the menu, the item interface was like Tomb Raider in that game.
Yes.
The old Tomb Raider.
Box. It's more like a shopping basket you see on some online stores where it pops in from the side.
And I love the feedback you get from this interface. So when you mouse over to the right side of the screen, you pull out the inventory. And then to combine items, you drop them into two different slots, because a lot of the puzzles in this game involve combining items you have in your inventory. And I love the feedback you get when it doesn't work, and I love the feedback you get when it does work. Like, it feels very satisfying when you actually can combine items successfully. It just, the little sound effect it makes and the little pop it makes into your menu, I love it.
Yeah, the way you combine them is like very intuitive, and you're right, it's super satisfying when you get it right. Just that noise it makes.
Yes.
And watching the two items combine, that's great too.
It's like a magic trick almost.
Yeah. I also noticed you never end up with too many inventory items in this game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are zero red herrings. Like, the episodic nature, like I said, helped because you generally start fresh at the beginning, mm-hmm. maybe chapter. Like, I didn't have to carry a useless prosthetic butt with me till the end of the game, like an Escape.
Or, like, a number of prosthetic pieces, like, that you can actually get in that. I think, spoilers, when you play as another character, you do have red herring items, but they're just as a joke later in the game.
Oh, right, yeah.
But they're not actually used on anything, and it's not there to screw with you or anything like that. But, in general, the UI in this game is really well done. This is a very simple thing, but I love when you go to the options screen or you go out to the menu. I love how it pulls out through a jungle, and then when you go back to the game, it pushes back into the game. It's such an easy effect, but it's so, so well done. It just feels neat. And just like a thumbs up on all the UI and the interface on this game. It's really, really well done. I did not have to fight it in any way. Like, there was no struggle. It never got in the way of me doing anything, and that's really important in an adventure game.
I think my only complaint about this game is the jungle maze can be a little bit annoying, but getting to warp to the beginning at any point was super helpful.
Yes, I'm glad they put that in there, and we'll talk more about mazes. There's a little much too much of a reliance on mazes in this in the first half of this game, but that's one of my few issues with it. But we can move on and talk about graphics. So it's 2009. This is kind of a budget game. Telltale games are beginning to look a lot more sophisticated compared to where they began a few years ago. This is important to note, because this is one of the few WiiWare releases by Telltale. I believe the other one was the Strong Bad game. And because they chose to be on WiiWare, their design was constrained by the 40 meg limit of a WiiWare release. In 2009, you had 40 megs available to you to launch a WiiWare game. That seems ridiculous. And that is why in Flotsam Island, the club is called Club 41, because it was named after the mythical 41st meg they couldn't use, because this game was a WiiWare release. So, yeah, I feel like in terms of what they were working with to make each chapter only 40 megs for WiiWare, they really got the most out of the incredibly restrictive amount of space they could use for each chapter.
Okay, I was wondering if there is some kind of joke behind that club name. That's great.
Yeah, and I feel bad. Like, out of all the titles, I wish they would not have chosen this one to release on WiiWare, because Nobody cared about WiiWare, and this game maybe could have been a tiny bit more polished if it wasn't, you know, also a WiiWare release, because, you know, it does look good, and I think the graphics, when up-res, they hold up really well, but it does still look like a budget game, although they do as much as they can to cover up the fact that it is a smaller budget release.
I'm sorry, but what is WiiWare? Is that the game engine?
WiiWare...
for Wii games?
No, exactly. You asking about WiiWare explains why nobody cares about WiiWare. WiiWare was the short-lived digital marketplace for the Wii, in which... it's different than Virtual Console. WiiWare is when you downloaded individual games onto your Wii, but there was a 40 meg limit, and it was very short-lived, but Telltale released a Strong Bad game on WiiWare, and they released this on WiiWare, along with other platforms. And there were some WiiWare exclusive titles, and maybe there will be a WiiWare Retronauts in the future, because it is lost to time.
I guess I'll have to listen to that, because I had no idea what that is.
Yes, you're right to ask that question. In fact, many people at home were like, WiiWare? What's WiiWare? Yes.
Why was it limited to 40 megs?
A lot of marketplaces had very small file size limits back in the day, way early on. Like Xbox Live Marketplace, I believe Castlevania Symphony of the Night was the first one to break their incredibly small size restriction.
Okay, well, that definitely explains a lot about the graphics.
Yeah. Yeah, like they wanted to actually have more in certain chapters. Like chapter one was designed to have you go inside the Club 41, but they ran into that size restriction. And I assume that the PC versions that we played are uncompressed, because the audio does not sound compressed. It doesn't look like a 40 meg game. When you download them, I think they're much bigger than that.
Okay, well, like throughout the series, there have been jokes about Guybrush going into a place and you don't see what's happening. You just hear what's happening. I thought they were just playing off of that.
I thought so too, but apparently they wanted you to go in. And yes, okay. So this game is designed not even for the 360 PS3 generation, but for the previous generation. It was built to run on Wii, which is not technically of the same generation, even though it kind of is. It's lesser hardware. So based on that, I still think it holds up rather well for 12 years later.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely looks a little dated, but it holds up pretty well thanks to the style they used, unlike Escape. I keep comparing to Escape, but it's hard not to.
We can't stop talking about it, because this game is such a departure from that. In that Escape,
yes,
in some small ways, it was inspired by the Cursed art style and like the swirly clouds. This one is a great mix of the extreme exaggeration of Curse and the more down-to-earth style of 2, Monkey Island 2. I think they found a great compromise between those two, and that is evident in the design of Guybrush, who... Guybrush yes. is lanky like he is in Curse, but he has the coat and the beard and the earrings of Monkey Island 2.
Yeah, even though I still prefer a slightly more realistic depiction of Guybrush, like in the first two games, I was surprised by how much I like him in this version of him. They got rid of his dumb fancy lad coat and Trump Pence logo buckle in Escape.
He's too much of a fancy lad in Escape. I don't like it. I went back to look at him and I was like, I can't believe I played as this character for 20 hours.
I know, it just doesn't feel right. Plus, he's wearing a red coat, which I don't like, and he's wearing his Secret of Monkey Island outfit through a lot of the game, which also doesn't make sense. Yeah, like this looks mostly like Lux Chuck's Revenge Guybrush, my favorite design, but it does take his lankier stylization into account as well, and it's a great evolution of his cartoonier design overall. Like, I love the multiple earrings, and like he gets a hook at one point. This is the most pirate-y Guybrush has ever seen, has ever looked.
Yeah, I also like the mutilations he goes through. Like in these are not spoilers, by the way, but in chapter one, you have a LeChuck hand for your left hand. In chapters 2 through 4, you have a hook instead of a left hand.
And like I said before, his beard is back.
That's right. Yeah, his beard, which only appeared in Monkey Island 2, right?
Yes, and he was so proud of it, and then he lost it in the next game for some reason.
Mm. Beards were not
and this
in.
Is also. Like, I'm not sure if this is my favorite Guybrush. It's really up there. Like, I think 2 is still my favorite. But I think this is my favorite version of Elaine.
Hmm. And why is that?
She just looks very sweet. And I like her outfit. Like, she also is less fancy compared to the previous game. I guess because she stopped becoming governor and she's more of a pirate now. And, like, she has these big green eyes that she apparently uses against Guybrush when she wants something.
Yes.
Which I think is cute.
And the animation, I think more attention is paid to major characters. They're more well animated. They have more animations. I will say the game starts off in a bad place because I think, and they talk about this in the commentary briefly, they thought they could use the same model and dress them up in different ways to make different NPCs. But then it was evident, like, no, these characters look too similar. So I believe in chapter one, you have three characters that basically are the same model with like some slight variations. And then you have two taller characters who are the same model with different variations, and it just doesn't work, which is why from chapter two onwards they find ways to make characters more distinct, the NPCs you talk to.
Yeah, that is another complaint I have about this game, just the template they use for all the NPCs. But you're right, they do work with it better, and now, especially understanding the great limitations they had file size wise it totally makes sense. But by the fourth chapter, when some of those characters come back, it was getting kind of confusing. I couldn't like tell some of the characters apart.
Because they're basically like the stout, like round model of the pirate, and then like the tall, skinny pirate, and they find different variations of those. And I was like, are you the thief or are you the newspaper guy? I don't remember.
Yeah. But you know, like, you know what? I think they do a really good job taking advantage of the fact that this is the most expressive characters have been, because I think this is the only game where when characters are talking, you zoom in on their faces.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And facial expressions play a big part in this game.
It does work really well, which is why I kind of want to see a new Monkey Island movie, because I feel like all this lip sync stuff and all this facial animation stuff could now be a lot more automated instead of like individually animated. And I feel like they were just on the cusp of that happening to them, but it still works very well in this series. Talk about design. So each episode runs about 3 to 4 hours, so if you want to play through this, it's about a 15-20 hour experience, so about the size of a Monkey Island game. And something I noticed about the design of this in general is that each episode follows the same format, but in a way that's not repetitive. And it's not like every episode does this strictly, but I noticed that in most of these episodes, there is a self-contained puzzle and then a more open set of puzzles in the middle. And then at the end, there's another smaller self-contained puzzle. It's sort of like a reverse hourglass design in terms of how the game flows with each chapter.
Yeah, like I didn't notice that myself, but now that you bring it up, that is true. They must have done it well then, if I didn't notice while playing it.
I think it's a good idea because the game starts off, each chapter starts off with a self-contained puzzle to get you into the puzzle solving move. There's not a lot of variables to play with. You're kind of locked down to one area, and it gets you into the mood to solve puzzles, and then you can go off and solve the bigger chains of puzzles. And then at the end, you're ready for the game to be over. So it's like, all right, you're locked down to this area now. Here's another self-contained puzzle to get through. I think it's a very smart way to build these chapters.
Yeah, this game doesn't give you as many chances to explore compared to some of the past games, but that also helps make it easier to play and that, not yeah. in an overly easy way.
That's fine with me because I kind of like the self-contained chapters a lot more when
yes.
especially the third and the fourth one where you're really locked down. I just feel like they find more creative puzzles than sending you out to random islands to wander around and look for things.
Somehow, without making it too hand-holdy, this game makes it clear when something doesn't work or you're not allowed to do a thing.
Yeah, Guybrush will often comment on it in a way that prevents you from getting stuck. Sometimes he'll be like, oh, I don't think I should get this now, or like, I don't know if I can do this now. Certain like comments like that. And one thing I will say, mm-hmm. if you want to play this game, turn way down the hit frequency, because their idea of a hint system in this game is to have Guybrush just say things out loud while you're playing if you're stuck. There's no way to just opt into it and then opt out of it. You have to either turn it up or turn it down. So if you want to not be spoiled for any puzzle, as soon as you start playing, turn it all the way down. Otherwise, he might spoil a puzzle for you.
Okay, yeah, I never played it with the hint system on. I was wondering about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did at first because I forgot it was even an option. I was like, why is he telling me these things? And I was like, oh, right, let's turn it down. Also, like each chapter follows the same format in that, and this is something I didn't notice until thinking about it, every chapter is about Guybrush trying to get away from the place he is and that's how each chapter flows. So, like, he's stuck in Flotsam Island in Chapter 1. He's stuck on Spinner K in Chapter 2. He's stuck inside a manatee in Chapter 3. He's stuck on Flotsam again in Chapter 4. And in Chapter 5, well, he's stuck in another place, and he wants to get out of that. So they're able to play with that idea a lot in a way that doesn't make it feel repetitive when you're playing through the series.
Yeah, that works well, because I think when you play an adventure game in general, like any adventure game, your goal is to go to the next place, find the next screen to explore as a player.
Yeah, the flow is very well done, and I do want to talk about some light spoilers here before we talk about the individual episodes themselves. So to kick things off, I want to know, Nina, what was your favorite episode of the five-episode series?
Well, first of all, I want to say the first chapter is definitely the weakest, which is unfortunate because it might kind of turn people away from it. If anyone hasn't played it yet, definitely go past that one. Like, play it, of course, you have to, but don't let that deter you, because it does get better from there. It really picks up.
It does, yeah.
And the last three chapters are so strong that they rank very close together for me. But for me, my favorite is 3. The very last chapter is a very close second, but 3, Lair of the Leviathan, I thought it was clever, and I had a lot of fun figuring out the puzzles, and it was also the funniest. Like, there were some genuinely hilarious moments in there.
That one, it was my favorite when I played it, but then 4 became my favorite because I liked the courtroom stuff, and there were some very clever puzzle ideas in there we'll talk about later, and that was the one chapter where I didn't have to look up a hint for anything. I got through it all on my own. So the other ones, I wouldn't have looked for a hint if I wasn't doing this for a podcast and I'd had a deadline, but for 4, I felt like everything was so well designed and I felt so smart, but I feel like every chapter just gets better from the beginning. So again, you're right. Don't let chapter 1 throw you off. It's not bad, but it's not indicative of where the series will go.
Yeah, and like I said, just because I like the third one, the middle one, the most, doesn't mean it peaks there and then gets worse or anything. I loved the last 3, and especially chapter 5, the last one, I love because it's super dark. And the events that lead to it are so bold and unlike anything I've ever seen in the series up to this point. And having to deal with the aftermath of those events left like a big impact on me.
Yeah, I want to talk about that brings you to like the formula of Monkey Island, where, like I said earlier, Curse and Escape felt like, okay, what do Monkey Island games do? Let's do all of those. This game is different in that there's not insult sword fighting. They don't find a variant of that. There's like parodies of it, kind of, but they're not annoying. I feel like they couldn't find a new interpretation, and they thought Monkey Combat sucked. We will not want to do Monkey
yes,
Combat again.
There's nothing like that.
So the two things I can think of is just like the puzzle where you're trying to romance a manatee, or trying to bring two manatees together to find romance. It's sort of like insult sword fighting, because you have like a predetermined amount of responses that are canned, and you have someone talking to you and you have to spout those back. And also later in the game, you have sort of like compliment sword fighting, or like reassurance sword fighting in the 5th chapter. But they don't try to be like, oh, let's find our version of that. I'm glad they didn't do that.
Yeah, it does an amazing job coming with variations on the insult sword fight variety of puzzle, where you have to give the correct retort to a line. It did it way better than Escape did. I'm going to bring up Escape again. with its arm wrestling, which was just
nothing. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, because that was just like insult sword fighting's greatest hits. And then the Australian slang fight, which should have been a real puzzle, but it wasn't.
Yeah, again, we talked about it, but I was like, that should have been the ultimate insult sword fighting, where you're trying to respond to this Australian slang that you don't understand.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's funny that you bring up those two puzzles that you did, because those were what I wrote down as being my favorite puzzles, like the language puzzle that was really clever, and the one where you're fighting two people at the same time, and one is saying like self-deprecating things, the other is doing legit insult sword fighting. And you have to cheer up one character while insulting the other by saying one line.
Yeah,
you got to find the one line that works for both of these.
It's very, very well done. And in terms of other things they subvert or play with, so yeah, we don't have a version of insult sword fighting. They just find creative ways to kind of riff on the idea that aren't irritating. Also, it's like, okay, we've had four Monkey Island games, and each one LeChuck is a different thing. What is he in this game? He's a human. I like how they did that. He's not, I mean, he will become something else that's not that different than being a demon, but for most of the game, LeChuck is a human, and I think that's a great, fun idea that I was not expecting when I first walked into this game.
Yes, human pirate LeChuck.
Yeah.
Did you like him?
Yeah, I liked the idea of LeChuck being a good guy who's just trying to understand what it's like to be a human and how he just can't kill people anymore.
Would you call him a himbo?
I wouldn't, but I could see how other people would.
Like, it's weird because the female characters in this game, like, say woof when they see him. Like, I guess he's supposed to be a big hunk, which I didn't really get.
Yeah, I wonder if that's what he looked like when he was alive or just a new design entirely, but I do like the idea. I like your interactions with him, and I like the new characters too, because I feel like the villain of Monkey Island 4, Escape from Monkey Island, he sucked. Ozymandrel, not good, not threatening. They kind of forget about him, and this villain, Marquis de Singe, I think he is a threatening villain. He is an interesting villain. You don't know what he's up to. He does seem threatening, and he seemingly commits murder in this series. And I think he's a very strong villain that sticks out throughout most of the chapters.
Yeah, I think he is a decent villain. I like that he's a bit of a body horror weirdo, and he loves to amputate people. And his motivations are very clear. He is well-written. He's not super memorable to me, though. Like, when I played this, I thought, oh, right, this guy. Like, I had completely forgotten about him.
For some reason, I thought he was only in the first chapter, but then I realized, like, oh, no, he is, like, the first major villain in this game.
And he's the second French villain in the series.
Oh, wait, who's the other French villain?
Captain Rene Rottingham.
Oh, right, yes, that's right, in the rhyming insult fighting, which I like.
Yeah.
And
it's always a foreign character, I guess.
It's true. We hate the French. And also, another major character in this is, I feel like one of the, it does feel like they're going for a new idea here in that they're sort of like a foil to Guybrush, who is almost always around you, at least in some chapters. That's Morgan Le Fay, a very clever pun on Morgan Le Fay. And I do like her because she is a pirate hunter who is also a Guybrush fanboy in a way.
They took a big risk by introducing a character like Morgan because she had the potential to be very annoying, like, or to be labeled as a Mary Sue. Like, she's cute, spunky, she's great at fighting, and like I said before, she becomes sort of kind of a love rival, and her character type of adoring fan has been done before, not in this series, but it's kind of a trope that I think people generally find annoying usually. And I like that Guybrush is clearly uninterested in her romantically, because he's firmly an Elaine sexual in this game.
He's a wife guy. He's a pirate
he really
governor
is.
Wife guy. Yeah,
yeah,
no,
like,
it was.
This isn't Guybrush from Escape. Like, I keep bringing it up. He never hits on her, and there are no like moments where they like, you know, reach for the same thing at the same time and accidentally touch hands and blush or anything like that.
She clearly has a crush on him for part of the game, at least.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Don't take it very far, though.
Just there's like glances, there's little looks and things like that. Like, it's mainly body language. But yeah, I feel like in previous Monkey Island games, once Guybrush was done with characters, he would just leave them behind. But it feels like this is the first time they've had a recurring not non-villain. Well, she's kind of villainous in a way, but it's like one of the few recurring characters I can think of that is so prominent in one of these games.
I like her a lot.
I want to see
more of her if they make another one.
There is kind of a cliffhanger at the end of the series that kind of shows you where she ends up. So I assume that if they make another game, she's so prominent in this game, they could really not ignore her.
I'm kind of surprised they didn't bring back some of the characters in the series, like Otis, Carla, the Swordmaster, and Herman Toothrot. There's no Herman.
It's true. Yeah, I think after Escape was a big family reunion, and they really are more reserved in this one because it's really just Elaine, Guybrush, LeChuck, Voodoo Lady, and Stan. There's no Wally. There's no Herman. There's no Kate Capsize. There's I feel like they were really being conservative in that way, but in a good way, because Escape did feel too much like fan service, because it did feel like, oh, it's the 10th anniversary of Monkey Island. Let's bring all the gang back together. Let's start you on Melee Island.
Yep, I'm perfectly fine with not seeing those characters again.
Me too. They had their moments. Well, I'm sure Wally is fine. So now we could talk about the individual episodes and hopefully not go on for 3 hours, but we could because we really enjoyed these. And that the first episode is Launch of the Screaming Narwhal, and very interesting beginning to this one in that, again, this game, it basically the first puzzle is the end of the unmade Monkey Island 5. You are fighting LeChuck. You need to kill him with the Cursed Cutlass of Khlflu. But the first puzzle is one of the classic Monkey Island puzzles in which you are getting a substitute recipe for something. That goes wrong. Instead of killing LeChuck, you make him human. You curse Guybrush's hand, and then the pirate pox spreads throughout the Caribbean.
I noticed that since Curse, every game is started off with a sea battle and firing a cannon.
That is true, yeah, yeah. In Curse, you're on a ship. In Escape, you're on a ship. And in this one, you're on a ship. But in Escape, you weren't even fighting LeChuck's pirates. It was just random pirates.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it's a good place to start off from because it is very piratey, and it starts you in a very like confined location with very few things to do just to get you used to the mechanics of the game. I love how the ultimate insult, which you spent an entire game putting together, is now just an ingredient in a root beer cocktail.
Yeah, in fact, I think all of the ingredients for this cutlass are just the MacGuffins from previous games. It's like there's like the ring and the voodoo doll are part of it too.
Oh yeah, yeah, you're right.
So they're playing with the idea in that, well, this game is not about that. I mean, it kind of is, but it's not as much about that as the previous games were. And once you get to the first location of this series, which is Flotsam Island, this game, and Rod Gilbert's correct, puzzles of threes are the best kind of puzzles ever. And every adventure game should follow this logic because this game does them so well. And your first set of puzzles on this island is you need to make news on the island so the newspaper guy will let you meet Deep Guts, who is the voodoo lady, and she knows how to get off the island. So it's a puzzle of threes. You need to A, get in a bar fight, B, find a treasure, and C, seize a ship. And it's all done so, so well. And I always love when I see this in an adventure game. It's Ron Gilbert's basically Bible. This is written in there, but puzzles of threes are always rule.
Yeah, and I love how it starts off with Guybrush having an evil hand that kind of has a mind of its own because it almost feels representative of the player controlling him.
Hmm. You know, I never thought
like
of that.
Like, you're making him do things. Yeah. I kind of wish he played a bit more with that, actually. Like, having him steal things and being like, oh, I don't need this item. What am I doing?
Yeah, that only comes into play in the last puzzle of this, in which you have to point at the map to tell your, you know, first mate where to go, and your hand won't let you. So they only really have the evil hand play into one puzzle, I think.
Oh, yeah. Your first mate, Reginald Van Winslow. Did you like that character?
Yes. He's one of the, like, three identical pirate characters. Styles that they have there on the island, but they eventually find things to do with him, and I do like him.
He's a reference to Reginald Val Johnson, right?
Yes, and also Carl Winslow. Yeah,
yeah. Oh, I forgot to mention, like at the very, very beginning, when the game is teaching you how to play, basically, I like that he's kind of teamed up with Elaine at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. It sets the tone for the whole story. And, like, when I started up this game again, like, I remember, like, how much I like their relationship in this, and they show genuine affection towards each other without being, like, schmoopy about it. There's no, like, snarky jabs, like, in some of the past games. And I like how whenever Elaine says something sassy to him, like, she's never angry, she's kind of smirking, like, mm-hmm. She's amused by his idiocy.
It's very playful.
And this is more of a comment about the game in general, but this game in general just feels very more positive. All the characters are pretty friendly, although I guess because they want to contrast it to when they have the pox of LeChuck and they're nasty to you.
Hmm. Yeah, that could be.
Including Elaine.
But yeah, it's not less of a cynical and sarcastic game than previous ones for sure.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
And yeah, other puzzles in this chapter that I like are there's the stationary puzzle where you're captured by Desinge and you have to basically free yourself, but you're locked down into a chair and you can rotate the chair and make it go back. And based on like what kind of position you're in, it determines what you can interact with. And I really like the puzzles like that where you are just stuck in one spot and you have to play with all the variables and see what works.
Oh yeah, that was another good puzzle. That felt like being in one of LeChuck's death traps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, like when you're hanging in Monkey Island 2, I think.
Yeah, except this is at the beginning of the game.
Yeah, I always love puzzles where it's not about like roaming around and looking for things. It's like you're in one room or you're in one lockdown in one place. Figure it out. And
this was a good puzzle that used a monkey.
Yes.
The prosthetic store one.
Yes. And I think they were saying
so much trauma from that game. I'm sorry.
I'm trying to forget, but I think they said on the commentary for this they could only get away with electrocuting the monkey if the monkey liked it. So that's why the monkey enjoys being electrocuted.
I like that too. That was a good dark joke. Otherwise, it would be too cruel.
And another really good puzzle of threes in this chapter is that you basically, so the Marquis is using this this wind summoning device to suck all the wind onto the island so no one can escape. And you basically have to go around and alter these idols in different ways to get them to stop the machine from working. And the first one is a gimme. You basically put this weather vane on top. It shows you how to arrange the parts of the idol that kind of spin around. There's three different ones you have to alter in different ways. One, you put this nose sconce on that you pull off of a wall. One is that you put a cheese wheel on it that you have to put the imprints of from some other wall. Another one is you just have to look at the weather vane because there's no other clues around. So you just look at one of the designs on the vane and know how to turn to different parts of the idol. I thought that was really well done. And again, another puzzle of threes.
I didn't like navigating the jungle because it actually took me a while to realize you're supposed to listen to the sounds.
That's right. And this this chapter and chapter two have they're not as bad as old school mazes, but they are mazes still. And a lot of them are just they feel like busy work. They feel like padding because you're right. So there's a map and you have to listen to the sounds because the map shows you like which sound to go to next. So when you have to go to
animal sounds.
Yeah. You have to go to where the border of the screen is and make sure it's making the right sound before you move on. So it's not like something that's hard to do. It just requires a lot of busy work to do it.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of sound puzzles. I think this might be like the only puzzle that really relies on that in the series. Like sound, it feels kind of like missed in that way.
I think so. But if you have captions on, it does tell you like, oh, crickets chirping or birds chirping or whatever. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Okay. Well, that's not so bad then.
No. And then going through more things that happen in this first chapter, there's a final bottle puzzle when you're on the ship and you basically have to find a way to stick your hand to the ground so you can use your other hand to point at the maps because Winslow will not go anywhere unless you point at the map. He's a very map obsessed man.
He's got a weird map kink.
Yeah.
He's a kinky guy.
I like how they explore all the weird things he's into because at first he just seems like a pompous weirdo, but then they just like, oh, if you're going to be stuck with Winslow this entire time, we need to do more things with him. So on to chapter two, The Siege of Spinner K, I love how it begins because this is where we meet Morgan Le Fay. And for the first chapter, you have the LeChuck hand. At the beginning of this chapter, she cuts your hand off. And now Guybrush has a hook that will figure into a lot of things, mostly unlocking chests and doors.
Yeah, I just don't like how you have to select the hook every time when you want to use it on something.
Yeah, like I said earlier, it does feel like they're trying to work a different verb into this one-click interface. So it's not super satisfying, but it's a cheat that I'll allow because it still is a fun thing to use. I like that there's really not a trick. Like, the hook usually always works when you want to unlock something.
Yeah, but because of that, I wish it would just, like, make him automatically unlock things.
Hmm.
Every single lock, you have to use hook on the item. You would think that Guybrush would know what to do
point. He should just say, like, I'll use my hook
three times
after you click on
it
once.
Yeah, exactly.
This one, I think it's better than the first one. It's not super memorable, though, but again, it breaks down into another puzzle of threes in which you have to find these three summoning artifacts in order to find La Esponja Grande, which you hear about in the first chapter. So the story is you need the Esponja Grande to absorb all of the voodoo pox. And the first half of the game is basically you trying to find this sponge, this magic sea sponge, to eliminate the pox that you caused to spread throughout the Caribbean. And in this chapter, you are getting these summoning artifacts in order to find the location of the sponge.
And this chapter also introduces the Vakalians, the mer people.
Yes. And you know what? It was the year 2009. I was expecting some kind of off-color jokes about them because you don't know what gender they are, but they mostly avoid that, and I was surprised.
Yeah, it's not too bad. I feel like they're kind of a gay joke sometimes.
A little bit, yeah. They don't go as far as I'm expecting for this era, though.
That's true. I mean, Guybrush isn't sure what their genders are, but he's pretty okay with them flirting, which they do a lot. And I think he tries to flirt back at one point. And then Winslow is like super into them. Like, this is where he becomes kind of pansexual.
Yeah. You find out about his romance much later in the game with one of these fake aliens.
He also thinks Guybrush says, "I love you" to him at some point, and Winslow's just like, "Oh, we can discuss that later."
Right. Because he's
down for anything.
One of the things on the map is the Isle of You. So when you point to it, Guybrush says, "I love you." And then he goes, "Oh, sir, I didn't know." Not a lot of puzzles stick out to me in this one. There's another jungle maze, not really as annoying as the one in the first one, first chapter. This is something I don't like as much in that it's not as tied down to one location and that you can do a lot of sailing around to different little islands, but there's not a lot on those islands. And I think it just makes a lot of busy work just traveling around. One puzzle that stood out to me though, is I really like the puzzle in which you are helping LeChuck solve a puzzle, because it's like you're trying to help someone play an adventure game, but they don't want you to give away the entire answer. So you just kind of coach him through an adventure game puzzle and give him different like verbs and items to use. And I love that, because LeChuck, he doesn't know how to solve puzzles, because in previous games, all he does is kill people and use violence to fix things. So he's new to this. And as Guybrush, a seasoned puzzle solver, you're helping him through this.
Oh, yeah, that was great. I like dumb human LeChuck, because he always has been a bit of an idiot throughout the series. Another thing from the first game that's like throughout the entire season of these games is the pyrite parrot of Petaluma.
Yeah, they have him in the first chapter, and then they have to figure out different ways to use that character in every one. And
he keeps coming back, yeah.
He squawks, "I'm Guybrush Threepwood, Mighty Pirate," and they find various different ways for him to return, and I do like that. He's kind of like this game's Murray, although Murray does show up in this chapter. I'm sorry, in this episode.
So as a parrot owner, you're okay with this representation?
Yes, but I think the joke is like, this thing is annoying.
It's true.
But parrots can
be
annoying.
You get annoyed by your parrot.
It's true.
Yep.
He doesn't say, "I'm Bob Mackey, Mighty Podcaster," though, so I have to teach him that. Anything else from this chapter? It doesn't really stand out to me. I had fun playing it, but the final three chapters are really the best chapters. I feel like the first two are just a little bit lukewarm, but still fun. But chapter two, not a lot stands out to me in this one.
I do like how Elaine has written this one. Because Guybrush thinks she's in danger, but it turns out she's just been with LeChuck, helping him return all the monkeys he's kidnapped. And she does like ask him to do things for her. This is where she uses her eyes and just says, "Please."
Yeah.
Which is, I think is, it's just their variation on all the times Guybrush has said "please" over and over to another character. So this is a fun subversion of that. Like, he's someone on the other receiving end this time.
And there's like, again, there's maybe hints for the player, like, oh, are Guybrush and Morgan are a thing now? And now there's even hints in this chapter like, oh, Elaine wants to hang out with human LeChuck so much. I wonder why. But in the end, you find out why.
Right. Yeah. I forgot that they do kind of play the jealousy aspect here too, but not too much. Like, Guybrush isn't going to like storm up to her and go like, "Oh, what are you doing with him?" or accuse her of anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, you could tell, like, they genuinely like love each other. And she makes them do things, ask them to do things, but it's not like in a certain other past game where she's just like commanding him and he's like going shopping for her or whatever.
Yeah, while she's doing important things, she's sending you off to run errands or whatever. Yeah, I like this. And I also think that this is really Elaine's most prominent chapter, and this is the chapter she has the most interaction with Guybrush, and I think that's because, like, there's not a lot to really mine from that anymore because they've done that so much. So I feel like they still want Elaine in the game, but there's not a lot of new material to get out of her and Guybrush together, so there's really more of a focus on Guybrush and Morgan.
Yeah, she's good at handling political matters, and that's what she does in here.
Yeah. And in most fiction, I'm sure there are other examples, but whenever the couple actually gets together, like, that's when their story becomes boring. Like, it's always like,
yeah, that's true.
The act of them getting together is what's exciting, and then when they're still together, they're boring. I mean, we're boring now. I've come to terms with that.
No, like, I can't think of any other game where the protagonist is married and you see a lot of their spouse.
Yeah, usually in a game, if a protagonist is married, their spouse is killed and it's like, "I must get revenge."
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. No, I just love how you get to see them interact and they're sweet to each other.
Mm-hmm. It's a good example, I think. So at the end of this chapter, you get swallowed by a leviathan, or sorry, a manatee, and then you end up in chapter 3, Lair of the Leviathan. Your favorite chapter, Nina. I like it a lot too, and I like how tied down you are to basically two rooms of this area, of this inside of a leviathan, and there's a lot of like puzzle density in this chapter that I do really like.
I also forgot to bring up, you learn a lot about the voodoo lady in this game.
Yeah, because she's
more than any of the other games.
She's not just around to dispense wisdom, because you leave her location rather quickly. And she plays a lot more into the later part of the series, but I do like what they do with her in this one. And you find out about her lost love, who is in this chapter, Coronado da Cava, who actually, he was an explorer. He went off in search of the sea sponge that you need to cure the LeChuck pox. And you find him inside of the manatee. He's gone kind of mad. His crew has mutinied and now lives in the stomach. I love what they do with this, and I love, again, how it's tied down. And it starts off with a fun bottle puzzle in which, when you start the chapter, Morgan is unconscious from what happened to her, you know, getting knocked out from going to this manatee. And while you're, like, you know, searching her, and she's babbling to herself, you're learning things about her that will let her play off, because you have to pretend that you're married to her, and then you play this version of a newlywed game with Coronado, where he asks you things about her, and you have to answer them based on what you remember when you were searching her body and hearing her babble to herself at the beginning of this chapter.
Yeah, that's fun, and when they have to pretend to be married, it doesn't get very awkward either. Like, they don't have Guybrush creep on her, like I said, and she's not all like bashful around him. They're just like, yeah, there's a thing we gotta do. We just gotta roll with it.
It's great that they don't make Guybrush like horny for her at all. Like, he's annoyed by her, but there's never any like, what about Morgan? It's like he does not even consider her like a sexual or romantic partner in any way, and I think they got that completely right.
Yeah, even though she's, like, very cute and pretty.
Yes, she's a very cute character. And I think even, like, in Escape from Monkey Island, which we'll bring up again, like, Guybrush was using that dumb Barry White voice on a lot of female characters in the game, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, and they don't make him do that in this game.
No,
thank God.
Thank God. I mean, it's funny. It was funny in 2000, briefly, but not in 2009.
He hits on every female character in that game. It's ridiculous.
It was a weirdly horny Guybrush, but he's back down to earth now.
Well, they have to pretend to be married because Coronado thinks he's after the voodoo lady.
Right,
or him
right.
And the voodoo lady have something going on together.
There's a lot of weird love triangles in this game, or potential love triangles in this game.
But I really like how you learn about the voodoo lady's past a little bit. Like, she has a life outside of her little hut.
You eventually learn that she can't
this
stand up,
though.
This
is also my favorite design of her, too.
Oh, you like the skull makeup that she has?
Yes, it's awesome.
And I was going to say, you actually learn that she can't stand up.
Oh, yeah.
When you take over her body. This chapter has another puzzle of threes in that you go into the stomach of this manatee, and basically you have to convince them all to let you join their brotherhood, so they let you know how to find the cochlea, which you need to put back in the manatee to steer it back to its mating ground where the sponge is. And it's a puzzle of threes because you have to convince all of them and also the dead member of the crew to vote for you in this brotherhood so you can learn where the cochlea is. And I love all of these characters, how you interact with them, how you convince them all. And what did you think about this? You like this chapter the most.
Yeah, I like those characters too. Like I said, this was the funniest chapter to me. And I really like how these characters were written and voice acted. That's the mutinous crew of Coronado. Moose, Noogie, and Bug Eye. And Santino is the dead one. He's just a skeleton. And Bug Eye is my favorite of all of them. Like, he's the most well-developed, of course. Mm. And I also like the return of Murray here. Like, I think I mentioned on the Curse podcast that Murray is a big fan favorite, but he never really did much for me. And I think the way he was used in this chapter was great.
Yeah, they don't make him come back. And then in future chapters, Guybrush is afraid he'll come back. And actually, during the credits of this one, he floats down next to the credits and makes fun of them. I like how they use him only in this chapter. It's sort of like Hypnotoad in Futurama, where it's like you gotta like go light on Hypnotoad because it's only funny for so long. But Murray, they use them just enough in this.
And this also has the face-off minigame, which I enjoyed.
Yeah, I like the little system they built because instead of an insult sword fighting contest, you have a face making contest. And the way you win is to make a different face based on different variables. And you have to learn how to make different faces from both people and also things you see around the environment. So you're like learning a face making vocabulary as you go through the game.
I guess the only thing I don't like about this chapter is they don't give Morgan a whole lot to do.
Yeah, she kind of just is, like, pouting a bunch inside the stomach, and yeah. You use her to go on a date with Noogie. I like that puzzle, too, because you have to tell her what to do, but it also has to sound like a date to the character. So, like, you're telling her to interrogate him, but to him, you have to make it seem like he's on a date with her. So your instructions have to be both an interrogation and what could potentially be a date, and I like that.
I guess they play with that a lot in this game. Where you're trying to do one thing, but your tools are limited. Like the language puzzle with a manatee.
Yeah, I really like that.
You only have you have to communicate to the manatee with stock travel phrases when you're trying to woo the manatee.
Like, let's go to the library, or where's the police station, or things like that. You learn the manatee language, but you only know enough to get through this travel phrase book. And I actually failed this a few times, and not in a frustrating way where it's like, oh, this is a lot more nuanced than I thought it would be, because you have different categories of responses like food and entertainment and travel and things like that. But there are only so many things you can say back, and you have to find something that would match what the manatee is saying to you. And I really liked how much nuance there was in that puzzle. Nothing seemed immediately obvious. It was a lot of playing around with the language to figure out what would work.
Yeah, it's so funny, and it's like a reversal of the insult sword fight, because they're trying to intimidate you and you have to be charming in return in a way that makes sense with these talk travel phrases.
Yeah, I really like that puzzle a lot. And another puzzle I liked in this one was you eventually have to transport yourself to the voodoo lady's body. And there's a fun puzzle with these three cards on them. Each card has a character, and each card also has a verb on it, and you have to arrange the characters and the cards in a way to make the effect you want happen. And I found it a lot of fun just to play with the different cards and see what you could do.
Yes, getting to temporarily become the voodoo lady was amazing. I love how Garbage kind of like enjoys being in her body.
He is slightly
he
horny.
He kind of plays with himself a lot.
He is kind of horny when as soon as he gets into her body, he makes her breast bounce a little.
Yeah, I mean, they're fun. They jiggle.
I mean, yes, I guess if you're transported into that kind of body, you're like, okay, what's going on here? What's down below?
He's so used to being skin and bones. He doesn't know what it's like to have like jiggly parts.
It's true. He's a bird boy. And then at the end of this chapter, there's another bottle puzzle where you're strung up by Dakava, who realizes, like, you know, you're a traitor, and it's all about like the logistics of moving these two cages so Morgan can cut yours free. It's not difficult, but I love, again, these like lockdown puzzles where there are only so many things to do and just like playing with all the available options.
There are lots of puzzles in this chapter, lots of like very clever puzzles, and I think that's why I like this one so much.
Yeah, I like it. There's not a lot of like running around. It's a very puzzle-dense chapter, and I thought this was my favorite going into it, but I really like the fourth one now. Do you want to go on to talk about that one, or is there anything else you want to hit on later, the Leviathan?
We can move on to the fourth one, which I also liked a lot.
It's really good, and this chapter begins because Morgan knocks you and Wilson out at the end of this chapter, at chapter three. So you basically find out a very well-named chapter, The Trial and Execution of Guybrush Threepwood. You are brought back to Flotsam Island. Morgan is going to deliver you to DeSinge to be dissected, but you find out before that can happen, Guybrush needs to go on trial for a bunch of different crimes he's committed, seemingly. And I think this is playing with the idea that most adventure game protagonists are criminals and should be punished for what they do. Although Guybrush didn't do any of these things. Despite all the crimes he's committed in the past, he is being set up for all of these things.
Yeah, that's true. And this is a return of Stan. It's the best Stan, like I said. He's fast-talking and Phil Hartman-esque, and it's perfect that he's a lawyer in this.
It's great, and they found a way to make it. I think they did in the last game, too, but I like how his creepy jacket works in this design as well, where the pattern doesn't move, but he moves. I always like that.
And they later make it part of a puzzle solution, obtaining a scrap of that fabric.
You have
that
to
magical fabric.
Steal a bit of his garish fabric. So again, another puzzle of threes. Technically, there's four parts, but the first one is a gimme that you can get out of very easily. So Guybrush is on trial. He's locked down to the courtroom and the prison, but you can easily get out of the prison to explore a few more areas. So the crimes he's guilty for are for stealing an X, for burning someone's thigh with nacho cheese, for spooking a cat, and for stealing the Sponge Grande. And this is all about, like, it's kind of like Phoenix Wright style, and I think they might have been inspired by Phoenix Wright because this game came out like after the original trilogy came out in America, because it's not the same design sense at all, but it's about putting people on the stand, presenting information to them, asking them questions, and yeah, I really love this as a Phoenix Wright fan, even though the games play out very differently.
If they were inspired by Phoenix Wright, I wish you would lean into that a little bit more. By maybe having a dialogue puzzle where you have to find the contradiction in what they're saying.
Yeah, I can see that. But I do like how all of these play out because you have to find out why they're lying. I love the amount of fluids you carry around with you in this chapter because right. You're trying to find out why the woman, how the woman got the burn on her leg. And to do that, you basically need to collect every kind of fluid you can on the island. So before you solve this puzzle, you have eight little jars of fluid with you, or eight shot glasses full of fluid with you.
And thank God they don't make you refill those every time you use them.
Yes, I'm so glad.
You gotta go through a lot of combinations.
For some reason, I was worried at first, like, oh no, what if I have to go back and get these? Mm-hmm. But no, they always stay in your inventory, and that's very smart.
It's little touches like that that make this game so playable and fun.
And the puzzle I like the most in this chapter is the Feast of the Senses, which is another recipe puzzle in that. So you have the sponge and you have to decide how to make it grow. And you have to basically feed the sponge six different things that represent the six senses. And you have to decide, you have to figure out what those are based on the things around you. And I thought that was a very, very good puzzle. And I like how they do that same puzzle in the next chapter, but in a different way.
I would have liked this chapter more if we didn't have to return to the jungle again.
This is the one time I think the jungle is used well, in that you have a foldable map, and based on the way you fold the map, that is how the layout of the jungle changes, which is something I was not aware of the first time I played the game. That's the one time I got stuck in this originally, where they don't make it obvious enough that the layout of the jungle changes. There's like a bit of a rumble when you do it, but that, to me, does not signify that land is changing.
Okay, I thought that was a good indicator. Actually, because it only happens when you fold a map. I wish it happened outside of the jungle as well, because the rumble only happens when you're in the jungle and you fold the map.
That's probably what threw me off. But this time around, I had a lot of fun folding the map in different ways to find what I needed to find, and it was fun. But I love just the ways that this Feast of the Senses puzzle is interpreted in the game in terms of the things you have to put on the sponge in order to feed it. And this chapter ends with another lockdown puzzle. You are fighting DeSinge. You have to figure out ways to get him basically sucked into this wind-generating machine. And it's a fun puzzle. Again, I like every lockdown puzzle. But what this chapter ends with is a very shocking thing in which Guybrush is killed. And then earlier in the chapter, Morgan is killed. So you find her body. And that's a moment that really stuck out to me in this game. And I'm sure it did to you too, Nina, because it's a moment of like actual sincerity in Monkey Island, which is rare, even in the very best of the series, where you find Morgan's body. There's no music. Guybrush has nothing funny to say. It's like a scene of tragedy. And I think it's handled really well.
Yeah, it's great. It really surprised me. There's a lot of death in this one. There's Morgan DeSange, who is like obliterated.
He's ground up into a lot of pieces, yeah.
Yeah, and Guybrush. And I think this is the first time in the game series that you see characters legit dying on screen.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, LeChuck...
I can't think of any other times where a character just straight up dies.
LeChuck like explodes and things like that, but he's not living.
Yeah, like... Morgan dying had a big impact. You know what? I was thinking Morgan might be the character with the most character development in the entire series, in the entire Monkey Island series.
It's true.
If you think about it.
Because like I said earlier, most characters, they don't stay with you for the entire game. Like you visit them, you do their things, then you move on to the next set of characters. But in this one, she's usually hanging around after the first chapter in some way.
Yeah, and like aside from... like Guybrush, obviously, because he's a main character. She's a character that you see change most.
Yes.
Like at first, she's all about the money. That's all she cares about. But then she feels really bad about the things she did to Guybrush. And she tries to redeem herself in this chapter and then is killed for it.
And Guybrush is as well. And when I played this again, I was like, oh, I kind of forget what happens. This is a fake out. But no, because chapter 5 opens with Guybrush dead. You are now the ghost pirate Guybrush in the afterlife. And I feel like that's like a really big risk. I mean, death is inconsequential in a world in which there's a ghost pirate that comes back to life in every game. But I feel like that was a big risk. Like, oh no, you're dead for almost all of this chapter. You got to figure out how to get out of the situation.
Yeah, the ending to this is great. When Guybrush gets killed, it happens so fast that you don't even see it coming. So it's legitimately shocking because LeChuck has never been one to be so quick with the killing. In the past, like, usually he puts Guybrush in some sort of death machine, then leaves. In this one, he just comes up and stabs him. That's it.
Yeah, and it's revealed that LeChuck is behind all of this, because in Chapter 4, there's a bit of red herring in that human LeChuck is like, oh, the voodoo lady is behind this. This is why we're trapped in the cycle of fate. She sets us against each other, and we need to break free of this. But then you find out, oh no, LeChuck was, this is all a long con. He needed Guybrush to get the sponge because Guybrush can hold his breath for 10 minutes underwater, and LeChuck needs the sponge in order to suck the voodoo power out of the pirate afterlife so he can become a pirate god. And that was the big long con he was running for this entire chapters of the game.
This is also the chapter where Guybrush finally trusts LeChuck, because he's very skeptical that LeChuck is a good guy up until this point.
Yeah, it's true.
And he's all like, hey, buddy, like, did you believe that LeChuck is legitimately good up to this point?
You know what? I forgot the twist of this game, and I thought he was. I forgot that he's actually the villain, the true villain of the game.
Yeah, I think I kind of went through the same thing Guybrush did, where I didn't trust him. And then by this point, I was like, oh, maybe. I was like starting to loose into the idea of maybe LeChuck is actually a good guy. Because we kind of see that in The Simpsons and Sideshow Bob.
Yeah.
He's always trying to kill Bart. And then one time he's actually like not after him. Like, it is actually him trying to be good.
Yeah,
so I thought, maybe they're doing the same thing here.
I think they did a good job of fooling the player into thinking that maybe LeChuck has reformed. Maybe the fact that he's a human now means he's no longer evil, but no, he's still evil. And
he's kind of creepy at the end too, when he's like briefly still a human, but he's evil. He's saying evil things, but in a very cheery way.
Yeah, and it was a big surprise for me. I forgot this is where this episode starts off, because you basically have to dig yourself out of your own grave in the pirate afterlife. And I love the atmosphere of this whole location. And I love what they do with it. I love like the weird mythology they put into this area. And it all ties back into the first game as well. You find out like this is where LeChuck escaped from to come back to the land of the living.
So now we're in the fifth chapter.
Yes. Rise of the Pirate God.
Okay. I like any time you go to the land of the dead in a game. I know you haven't played this or seen this, but similar thing happens in King's Quest VI.
Mm.
Like, you don't die. You just enter the land of the dead. And I just find that whole environment super cool.
But this is a great place to start this game because I don't think the other games would make this risky choice to be like, well, you're dead. You might not come back to life. When you do come back to life at a point in this chapter, you are a zombie. So, like, how do you get your body back? It's rotting. Your body is like a corpse in the real world. Like, what do you do?
Guybrush goes through a few character design changes in Tales.
He does, yeah.
Like, I like his ghostly design, where it's pretty much the same, but you can kind of see his bones.
I do like that, yeah. And he does get his hand back when he's a ghost,
right? Yeah. So that ferryman at the beginning, is that supposed to be like the ferryman in Curse?
I think it's supposed to be just like the mythological ferryman to cross the River Styx or whatever.
But he sounds so much like the ferryman in the Curse, and Guybrush keeps asking him like, "Hey, haven't we met before? Are you sure?"
I felt
like it was kind of supposed to be a nod to that.
I think maybe it might be, but they're just borrowing from that mythological idea of, you know, paying the ferryman to take you across the river. But that's where this episode starts. There's a bottle puzzle in that you weren't buried with the pieces of eight over your eyes to pay the ferryman, so you have to find a way to get it. And that involves stealing his tip jar and using the grog machine to make change, which I really liked. There's a grog machine in the afterlife, which much like the grog machine that stands in Monkey Island 1.
Yeah, I think there's a grog machine in every game. Is there one in the third game, actually? Maybe not.
I don't think so. But yeah. What you need to do, you basically have to solve the puzzles in each of these three areas of the afterlife. There's the sword fighting area, the thievery area, and the treasure hunting area. So it is a puzzle of threes, and you're using it to get four items to put in a ring in order to go back to the land of the living. But that does not mean you get your body back. It just means you can go there.
The three areas are a nod to the first game as well. Because it's thievery, what was it? Thievery, sword fighting, wait.
Thievery, sword fighting, and treasure
sword
hunting.
Sword fighting, yeah, no. Sword fighting, thievery, and treasure huntery.
Yes. Are those the three tests that the pirates make you do in the first game?
Yes. That's okay. Exactly what it is, and that exact wording.
And they set this up early in the series because when you go to the voodoo lady's hut, there's her rug that has the pirate voodoo crossroads or whatever, and that's where you are at the end of the game.
I wish he brought back Nord Treblig from her hut.
Oh, yeah. He does not appear in this. Although, I think Galeb says that's his name, the lion guy.
Oh, yeah, at one point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
he's an interesting character as well.
Yeah, I do like him. There's sort of like a sad quality to everybody in this afterlife area, which I like. I like the melancholy of it. Morgan is dead. She will not come back to life. She has a lot of regrets.
Surprisingly.
Yeah. And she ends the series as a ghost. But the main puzzle of this, after you get those four items to go back to reality, is you have to do a reverse Feast of the Senses, which it's sort of like a Diet of the Senses. So in the previous chapter, you had to feed the sponge. Now you have to find ways to basically starve the sponge. And again, it is all about finding six different items to give to the sponge that have a meaning in terms of like sight, sound, touch, sixth sense, and smell and taste. I don't know if I said that before, but how did you feel about this? It's sort of a repeat puzzle, but I love the inversion of feeding the sponge in this final chapter.
Oh, I loved it. In some of the past games, when you have to go through a voodoo spell, like gathering ingredients, usually you then have to repeat the same thing, but with limited items or substitutions that aren't as good. And I felt like they kind of wanted to touch on that, but do an inversion of that, which I thought was really clever.
Yeah, I did like it, and I like how in this section of the game, there are a bunch of tears in the fabric of reality between the afterlife and the real world, and it involves like going into them in different states. Like you can temporarily get your body back when you're in the real world as a zombie, and you have to do that to do certain things. I just love like playing with the two different worlds and what you can do in each one as a ghost and as a zombie, because as a ghost you can't actually touch things or pick them up, which I thought was an interesting choice.
Yeah. No, that was great. When you're a ghost, you kind of have to do like dialogue puzzles instead.
And I guess we could talk about where this all wraps up in that essentially you can starve the sponge, but you still have to fight LeChuck at the end of the game. I don't like this puzzle because I felt like I just never had enough time to figure out what to do in each station. But essentially, like, they try to replicate your LeChuck fights in the other games in that you are... he's pursuing you, and you have a limited time in each area to make a decision about what you want to do with limited items in each area. But in this one, I felt like I had to find a hint because I was just getting too frustrated about what to do in each little station he knocks you to.
This is my biggest complaint about this chapter, for sure. By this point, I was like looking up the solutions because I just wanted to get it over with.
Yeah,
I don't want to go through the same things over and over and over again to figure it out.
It felt like it took too long to move you between each station, too, because how it works is that, like, LeChuck, you have a limited time in each area. You can't move, and you have a limited time to decide what you want to do before LeChuck shows up and just punches you to the next area. And I just felt like there was never enough time for me to figure it out, and how it actually solves itself is not very satisfying. So I know they're trying to do the LeChuck showdown like there is in every game, but in this one it doesn't feel as snappy. It just feels a bit tedious to me.
But I do like how Guybrush is genuinely suffering.
Yes. Yes.
He sounds like he's like severely beaten up, because he is, and like his voice acting is very well done. He's very strained. And it's good that Elaine is very proactive in this as well and helps him.
Yeah, it's, you think that she has fallen under the spell of the Chuck, but it's all like a long con, right? For her too as well?
Oh yeah, this is where she like deliberately gives herself up to LeChuck, saying, oh yeah, I'll be your demon bride. And then she gets a really cool makeover where she becomes goth Elaine.
And Guybrush cool thinks she's hotter like that, is what he says, I think, in some dialogue.
I'm sorry, what?
And Guybrush thinks she's hotter like that. She's like, you're actually pretty attractive.
Oh, yeah.
Like this.
He says, I thought you were sexy when you were all poxed up.
Yeah. And the way this is solved is that you have to get LeChuck stuck in the rift between worlds so Elaine can stab him on one side and Morgan can stab him from the other side, because you have to destroy both his physical and spiritual forms. And what you do in this, and I think it's very thematically interesting, is that Guybrush... when he's a ghost, he has a shred of life as an item. He's holding on to a shred of life. And in order to close the rift on LeChuck and destroy him, Guybrush has to sacrifice his shred of life, seemingly trapping himself as a ghost forever in the afterlife. But there's a fun like little play with the puzzle in that before you had to arrange a ring of items in order to open that rift originally. And in this one, when you get to this part of the game, you sacrifice your wedding ring in order to go back to the other world, which because it's a ring of sacrifice and courage. And what are the other verbs I'm looking for? Sacrifice, courage, guide, anchor. Those four qualities make up your ring as well, your wedding ring.
That final puzzle is so incredibly sweet. I get emotional just thinking about
Aww.
It.
Yeah, and it's great because you've defeated LeChuck, and then you're stuck in this one area. There's no music, and you don't know really what to do. Like, oh, is this the end of the game? Like, did I mess up? Did something go wrong?
Yeah, and you don't have like anything left in your inventory except for your ring, right?
Yeah, I think that might be it. There may be a few other things, but I mean, eventually you will find the solution, but it was obvious to me what it was.
Yeah, once I realized what the final solution was, I was just like, oh, that's so sweet. And we got a real ending in this game.
I was also surprised by how brief it was, though, because it does wrap up very quickly. At least there's dialogue. But,
true, yeah.
But they just kind of sail away.
The ending to your curse, at least.
Yeah, they sail away. Elaine tells them they've been pronouncing a sponger wrong the entire time.
Yeah,
that's the joke.
Bon-ha.
And the stinger at the end is that we see that Morgan is now working for a voodoo lady. Morgan is a ghost, so she's a ghost pirate hunter now. And I guess that was because they wanted to give her some purpose, because it's kind of a bummer that she does die and can't come back. But now she has a purpose in life, or death, rather. And the final stinger in this game is very perplexing because it came out in 2009, and that if you wait past the credits, past the Morgan scene, you'll see SamandMax2010.com, which is not a real website anymore. Don't go there. So it ends with stinger for the next Sam & Max game, or like they raise a Max pirate flag and they're just previewing the next game.
That really kind of ruined the mood for me at the very end.
Yeah, I always hate when I go to, when I play an old video game and they advertise a website that does not exist. Like, renew your domain name. It's not hard. It's not that expensive.
Yeah, I
can do it.
I wish they didn't have that at the very end of this after such a nice ending.
If they re-release it, they should just patch that out because that's no longer true. You can buy Sam & Max Season 3 now, and it's great, and we'll talk about that maybe in the future. But that's the end of our Tales of Monkey Island podcast. We went into great detail about these episodes again. I hope you didn't listen to this before playing, but if you did, forget what we said and play through the series, and you'll really enjoy it. I think they did such a good job. And my question for you, Nina, as a fan, do you think the series has anywhere to go from here? Like, what could another game be in the Monkey Island series?
I think they've done all they can with LeChuck, and any more of him would just be repetitive. So I would like to consider this the end of the LeChuck arc. And let's bring in a new villain. Like, there's lots of potential there. Keep doing the ghostly supernatural stuff, because I love that. Especially with the voodoo lady possibly being a mastermind who's been manipulating everyone. I wouldn't mind seeing more of that explored. And also, let's bring back Morgan. Maybe her mentor can be a new villain, because he's a big pirate hunter.
Hmm.
I guess she's a pirate hunter. Her mentor isn't necessarily one. I was thinking about how the Pirates of the Caribbean movie series kept coming up with new antagonists. And the fifth one, played by Javier Bardem, was great. Like, he played an undead pirate hunter who wants the Trident of Poseidon to kill every pirate. That feels very Monkey Islandish to me. So come up with something like that. Like, let's just not do LeChuck anymore.
Yeah, I'm totally with you there. I feel like this is, I don't know if Earl Bowen's going to come back. I don't want anyone else to play LeChuck, and I think they've done everything they can. There's no other form for him to take. And if Monkey Island comes back, and who knows if it will, I feel like the series really shows you don't have to go down the Monkey Island checklist to make a Monkey Island game. You can kind of do your own thing while still being respectful and make a very fun experience that is still a Monkey Island game, but also is something new. You're not just retreading old ground. And I hope if it ever comes back, and I mean, we hit the 30th anniversary, nothing happened. I guess this is technically the 30th anniversary of Monkey Island 2. Nothing is happening now. Maybe if Ron Gilbert gets the IP back, there could be something happening. But I feel like there's still places to go for this series, for sure.
But still, like, if this is the last game, last Monkey Island game ever, I would be satisfied enough with this ending.
Yes, I agree.
It's like I said, it's a great tribute to Garbage and Elaine in general.
This could be the good final game of the series if it ends up being that, and it's not the final game that Escape was, where Guybrush's last words are Jar Jar. That could have been Guybrush's final words on this planet is Jar Jar.
It's interesting what a sweet note this game ends on, because that wasn't really the tone of the game at the very beginning of the series.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think it was a perfect storm because Ron Gilbert was there. Dave Grossman was overseeing everything. We have old LucasArts guys working on the project and a fan like Jake Rodkin and other people working on the series. So it was a mix of old talent and Monkey Island fans trying to make the best possible sequel that they assume probably could never happen.
Yeah, I love this game, I gotta say.
Yes, thumbs up. You know what? Sometimes when I do Retronauts, I have to play games I don't like, and that's been happening a lot recently, or games that are just not exciting or kind of a chore. But like one day I was like, you know what, I'm not going to work today, but I couldn't not play this series because I was like, I don't want to work today, I want to take time off, but I really want to play Tales of Monkey Island. So that's how good this game is. Like, it made me do work even though I didn't want to.
Yeah, I totally agree. I kept wanting to play more and more of this game. I finished it like way sooner than I had to because I just wanted to keep playing it. It leaves me feeling good about games. You're like, yeah, I really like adventure games. I really like Monkey Island.
Yeah, after playing The Dig and then this, I'm like, oh yeah, you can actually make a good adventure game.
Yeah, this is great. When it comes to ranking the whole series, LeChuck's Revenge is still my favorite. Then it's Secret, Tales, Curse, and all the way at the bottom is Escape.
Escape is on a different list for me. Just like, I don't even want it on the same list. There's no comparing.
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed yourself playing this because you've been having a rough time having to consume media that you really dislike.
Yeah, you know what? It's not as good as this, but I'm looking forward to doing the Back to the Future episode with those episodic games because I do, again, like playing these episodic releases, I'm like, God, I miss this format so much. It's fun to just sit down and finish a game in one day or 2 days. It's just a good feeling and you can be done with it and move on. So, Nina, thanks for being show. Oh, any final thoughts? Any other final thoughts?
Oh, no. I just wanted to say this game left me feeling good.
Yes, me too.
It's just like a nice uplifting ending. And, you know, this game like says, like, your bond to your life partner is made up of guide, anchor, courage, and sacrifice. And like, that's how I feel about you. Like, aww. You're my guide and anchor. You give me courage, and marriage is about being selfless. And you give me life through these things. And, I think this game makes me feel good about being married.
Aw, that's so sweet. I didn't know this was going to have such a happy ending this podcast. But thank you, Nina. I appreciate that. And please let everyone know out there where they can find you and support you and everything that you do.
I'm on Twitter at Space Coyote. That's Space Coyote with an L at the end instead of an E. You can check out my art at spacecoyote.com. Go to fangamer.com, navigate collection, sort by artist, Nina Matsumoto, to see all my video game merch. I'm still waiting for Disney to give up Monkey Island so that there's a chance in hell that I can make Monkey Island merchandise. Go to sparkscomic.com to learn about my children's graphic novel Sparks, which is published through Scholastic. It's about two cats that pilot a robotic dog suit to save people. And the third book, which I've spent most of the pandemic drawing, is coming out February of next year. And I might have snuck in a certain pirate in one of the scenes.
Ooh, legally.
Yeah, it's not Guybrush. It's Thybrush Greepwood.
Greepwood, yes, we all know him. So thank you for being on the show, Nina. As for us, this has been Retronauts, of course. You can find us online at Retronauts.com. We're on Twitter as Retronauts. And of course, the show is completely supported by patrons like you, possibly. So if you want to be a patron and sign up and get some bonus stuff, please go to Patreon.com/Retronauts. Sign up there for $3 a month. You get all these episodes 1 week at a time and ad-free. And for $5 a month, you get a lot of bonus stuff. You get 2 exclusive full-length bonus episodes every month for $5 a month. And also a weekly column and podcast by Diamond Fight. That's a lot of bang for your buck, and there are higher tiers on top of that. And again, that is patreon.com/retronauts. We couldn't do it without all of our great patrons out there. As for me, I've been your host for this one, Bob Mackey. I'm on Twitter as Bob Servo, and you can find me other places too, like the Talking Simpsons Network, my other podcast network that I do with Henry Gilbert. That is at patreon.com/talking simpsons. Sign up there, you get access to everything 1 week at a time and ad free like we do here. But we also have lots of bonus miniseries like Talking to the Hill, our King of the Hill miniseries, Talking Futurama, Talking Mission Hill, Talking Critic. Over 100 miniseries episodes are waiting for you behind the $5 paywall at patreon.com/talking simpsons. We do a lot of stuff over there. Check it out. And that is all for us for this episode of Retronauts. We will see you next time. Take care.